the Environment and Natural Resources. Today is the 8th of April. We have a packed agenda, so we're going to get going. We are going to conclude the public hearing from last time that we'd carried over to this time on Senate Bill 716. And then we will have a public hearing on Senate Bill 125. And then we will have a Senate bill hearing on Senate Bill 803. And then finally, probably about the last half hour of committee, we will open up a public hearing on Senate Bills 544, 846, 847, and an informational hearing on LC 4094. And we'll open up those four at the end together, because I think there are a lot of people that will want to testify on all four at the same time. So having said that, we're going to get going with by opening up. We're going to start with we need to do the work session, right? No, we'll just carry this over. Okay. And I'll announce that Senate Bill 266 is going to be carried over again until our next meeting time. So if you're here for Senate Bill 266, we won't be doing anything with it today, so we're carrying that over. Having said that, we'll open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 716. And we'll start out by calling up... I'd like to start out with Aaron Nichols, Bob Brooks, and Carol Chizarek. Three of you here? Or two of you, or one of you? Okay, if only one is here, then Stephen Kafori, if you could join her. And Michael Salvaggio, Audubon. Salvaggio here. What's that? He's got three hearings. Okay. If he bounces back in here, we'll get him up. And then next up then would be after this panel, we'll go with Aaron Doyle and Mary Kyle McCurdy. And I think that will conclude everybody that signed up. And then I have some follow-up questions. So go ahead.
Chair Edwards and members of the committee, my name is Carol Chizarek. I live in Forest Park neighborhood. I've provided you with some written testimony, and you got some written testimony from the neighborhood on Monday. Forest Park neighborhood includes the 5,000 acres of Forest Park, and we're located in western Multnomah County. We oppose Senate Bill 716, and the amendments don't resolve our concerns. In 2007, my neighborhood started working with Representative Greenlick and Senator Avakian on Senate Bill 1011 to authorize urban and rural reserves in the Portland area. I testified at those hearings, and I spent the next 3 years of my life volunteering on this process full time. An amazing thing happened in 2007. The Portland metropolitan region, three counties and metro, came together and agreed on problems with the existing UGB system. They agreed on the problems, and they agreed on a solution in Senate Bill 1011. Last year, they came together and agreed on House Bill 4078. They were also required to agree on the reserves designations. No one acted alone. All those parties had to work together. But Senate Bill 716 would allow a single county to change those hard-won regional decisions. Urban and rural reserves were our pilot project. Please don't undermine that. Our residents worked hard for 3.5 years to ensure that our important natural features were designated as rural reserves. We were successful, largely because of Deborah Kafori's support. Senator Dembro asked on Monday about Multnomah County. The county hasn't, as far as I know, taken an official position. If I need to, I will go back and work with them to get an official opposition. I'm really hoping that I won't need to, because they're busy with a lot of other things. We were tired of fighting UGB battles every 5 years, and urban and rural reserves promised 50 years of protection. If this bill passes, we'll have to defend our rural reserves every 10 minutes from deep-pocketed development interests who will lobby our county board for changes, and we'll be worse off than we were before. The core premise of Senate Bill 1011 was regional cooperation and consensus, both on the problem and the solution. We don't have that with Senate Bill 716. Reserves promise to provide long-term certainty for urban infrastructure planning as well as rural areas. That helps ensure efficient investment of taxpayer funds and to provide long-term protection, as well as the long-term protection on the rural side. And this bill would eliminate that certainty for urban planning as well. The proponents argue that because no rural reserve acres will be lost, it's all okay. But if you knew about the rural reserve designation process, you would know that the specific areas being considered were key. You had to look at the land. Forested acres in western Multnomah County are not an equivalent of farmland in eastern Multnomah County. So please, don't allow a single county to undo our regional urban and rural reserves designations, undermining all of that work done by the region. This bill also shifts decisions about future urban areas and urban expansion away from Metro and gives that authority to an individual county, fragmenting decisions about where our urban growth goes and removing checks and balances. The counties do not have the same analytical tools or the objectivity that Metro provides. This bill would break the regional consensus model, and it breaks the promises of urban and rural reserves. Please don't implement this measure. If you want more industrial land in the metro area, you want to make it more available, there are better solutions. Ask Metro and the counties to work together and bring you a package of legislation. So please don't pass this bill. I would also ask in the future that you don't support legislation that would modify our urban and rural reserves unless there's a regional consensus behind it. Don't allow parties outside the metro area to make us into their experiment and undo our pilot project. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Stephen Cafori. I'm here representing the Oregon chapter of the American Planning Association, which represents 800 professional and citizen planners. We operate on both sides of the table, people representing developers and people representing government. Our organization supports state policies and legislation that fosters good community planning. We're opposed to 716 for the following reasons. First, legislation is not necessary. State law already provides a planning process for the identification and zoning of large lot industrial land. It's covered under statewide planning goal 9, economic development, and it's specific, and it's implementing rules under OIR 660 division 9. Secondly, the proponents of this bill have not identified a specific problem that requires the legislature to act in these counties. House Bill 4078 was passed in 2014 and intended to resolve several legal disputes regarding the metro urban growth boundary and the urban reserves adopted by each county. Third, both Washington and Clackamas counties, and I realize Washington may not be in this anymore, include some of the better performing agricultural lands in the state. The bill does not include safeguards to ensure Oregon's agricultural sector can continue without negative impacts. Finally, the bill allows these three counties to circumvent, three different ones, to circumvent the city the civic involvement and public process that you just heard greatly detailed that went into development in the urban reserve process. And we think overturning all that work, years and years of planning and citizen involvement, is a bad idea. We suggest that you not pass Senate Bill 716.
Thank you both. Oh, I'm sorry. Do I have any questions for the panel?
She's brilliant.
Okay.
She is brilliant. She's great.
Thank you both. Next up, Mary Kyle McCurdy, Aaron Doyle, and Congresswoman first, please. Any of you can lead off on it.
Good afternoon, Chair Edwards, members of the committee. My name is Mary Kyle McCurdy, representing 1,000 Friends of Oregon. We oppose the bill for two reasons. First, it's fundamentally unfair and undermines citizen trust in government. And second, the premise of the bill, that the Portland area needs more large lot industrial sites, is wrong. I'm going to try not to repeat much of the testimony that you've already heard and instead address some of the things that I heard discussed at the first hearing. But first, a little bit about the background to this. Citizens, organizations, businesses, local governments, farmers, you've heard all of that, came together to craft the urban and rural reserves process. Many compromises were made, But with this legislature's direction and rules adopted by LCDC, we built trust among ourselves that Carol Cheserek just described and agreed to rules that would govern not only the process but the policies to designate urban and rural reserves in the metro area. And I need to clarify something that was said at the end of the last hearing. The reserves program and the participation of so many is not just about process. It's about policies, and those are policies that this legislature established in Senate Bill 1011 and that we all worked hard to implement. As a member of Metro's advisory committee, we all spent many meetings and hours understanding things like the location and size of infrastructure, soil types, irrigation districts, road networks, much, much more. And I know those same discussions took place at the local level in all the counties. We all participated to designate rural and urban reserves, and in some ways the law was implemented correctly, and in other respects it wasn't. Nine sets of petitioners from all perspectives, local governments, developers, farmers, and more, appealed LCDC's decision. The Court of Appeals found that Clackamas County and Multnomah County had largely implemented the decision correctly, but there was one glaring exception. Washington County had not complied with the policies in the law. Because that decision came out during this legislature's 2014 session, this legislature did truly yeoman's work and in 2 weeks constructed a legislative settlement that saved potential years back on remand at the local level concerning Washington County. Every party to the reserves appeal, including every local government, including Clackamas County, came before this legislative body and swore their agreement to HB 4078 before the House Rules Committee, and legislators proclaimed that they would never undertake something like this again. Yet here we are again 1 year later. Some of the interests advocating Senate Bill 716 are simply, and I don't know of any other way to put it, losing land speculators. More than a decade ago, would-be developers bought land south of the Willamette River that they knew was farmland, and they've been trying to develop it one way or another ever since. But in the reserves process, that land was designated as rural reserves by Clackamas County, by Metro, by LCDC. Eight state agencies agreed with that designation. Those development interests were among those who appealed the reserves decision to the court, and they lost. That land was found at every level to have been correctly designated as rural reserves based on the policies this legislature established in Senate Bill 1011. Senate Bill 716 undermines the public's trust in this process. It will be difficult for 1,000 friends to be able to advise citizens or our clients to trust the word of government, whether in crafting new land use approaches, such as the reserves process, or negotiating to resolve individual land use issues at the local level. Turning to the fact that this is not necessary, and I think you've heard a lot about from Metro about the number of large lots existing in the Metro region, that there are 54 large lots in the Metro region, 14 are ready to go, the rest need some level of investment. According to Metro, the Portland region faces up to $31 billion for new infrastructure to serve the existing urban growth boundary areas by 2035. We cannot afford to add more unserved lands. That's why 1,000 Friends is engaged in efforts this session to work with business groups, and have been for many sessions, to fund industrial site readiness and brownfield redevelopment. It's also why we have tried for years to get Business Oregon and DLCD to take seriously the issue of conversion of existing industrial lands that are located inside urban growth boundaries. They've been converting to non-industrial uses in smaller sizes. There has not been much success in this. Investment in infrastructure, financing, and conversion prevention techniques, these are the issues we should all be working for to further economic development. I want to give just a few examples of the apparent lack of need for large lot industrial land, at least in the metro area. Metro has expanded its urban growth boundary several times for industrial uses since 2002. And as of 2009, only one of those sites has actually developed. Instead, we've seen existing large lots in the metro area and around Oregon converted to small lot industrial and to non-industrial uses. For example, there's a 74-acre parcel in the Hillsboro cluster, high-tech cluster, that was in a single ownership. In 2014, Hillsboro divided that into nine smaller industrial lots, ranging from 4.5 to 15 acres. We thought that was fine because those are the sizes of lands that are used for industrial users. However, that site is now being developed and marketed as a business park with a mix of industrial and non-industrial uses. And the first building that is being built is for an indoor golf facility. Another example, McMinnville has a 90-acre parcel of flat, large lot industrial land inside its urban growth boundary, served by a free-flowing state highway, Highway 18, near an airport, and in a single ownership. However, the owner of the land is a national shopping center developer who's attempting to convert the site to non-industrial use for a shopping center. 1000 Friends has taken the lead in opposing that conversion. We have written letters to Business Oregon, ODOT, it's their freeway, and LCDC with little response. And finally, a bill was just dropped, House Bill 3520, by a Clackamas County legislator that would make it very difficult for metro or local governments in the metro area to designate large parcels of regionally significant industrial land. It makes me question whether there is a need for large lot industrial lands in the metro area. And finally, something that wasn't touched on too much in the last hearing was Oregon's number two industry, agriculture. 716 would take land that is already supporting our number two industry, agriculture, for some speculative future industry. Production value of Oregon agriculture is at $5.4 billion, with added on products, it's at $22 billion. It's continued growing through the entire recession. Agriculture accounts for 15% of the state's gross product, and 1 in 8 Oregonians is employed in the agricultural sector, and it affects every county. We would not take land out of other industries, especially our number one industry or number two industries, to give to speculative other uses. We have a strong industry in Oregon, agriculture, and that is what we should be focusing on in economic development, among other things. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, thank you. My name is Elizabeth Furs, and I'm here to talk a little bit about values, and I know you've heard a great deal about values, values for farmland, values of open spaces, but out of a unique experience which I had, I want to point to another value, and that's the value of certainty. It's an economic value, and it's very real. In 1993, it was my duty to obtain funding for West Side Light Rail. We were in competition with Los Angeles. They obviously had a lot more clout than Portland did. But we were able to obtain the largest amount of funding for West Side for Light Rail because I had an ace in my pocket. I had Senate Bill 100. I could tell the appropriators that in Oregon we have certainty. If we put a light rail in, if it takes 5 years to build, we know what every acre is designated to. And we also know it's not just for 1 year, but it's for many years. That Oregon got the largest funding for light rail. We got $650 million. And I can assure the committee that we would not have got that if we had not had Senate Bill 100. Every time anybody or the powers that be meddle with this law, it means that citizens begin to lose their faith in the process. I know that in Helvetia we spent many, many hours, many, many thousands of dollars to appeal a bad decision which the court upheld our view. So fine, we got a good decision eventually, but to what avail if every year there is a new attack? The value of Senate Bill 100 is hard to quantify, but I can assure you that value is still there. And I would ask you as a committee to keep Oregon's word and kill Senate Bill 716. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, members of the committee.
Tara Boards, members of the committee, for the record, Aaron Doyle on behalf of the League of Oregon Cities. When it comes to the designating, preparing, marketing, developing of industrial lands, cities recognize there are many impediments for finding lots of various sizes and shapes. However, we feel Senate Bill 716 is not the solution at this time for a number of reasons. Primary amongst this is the fact that this bill would allow the counties to designate without consultation with the cities who will eventually provide the services to these reserves. Without that consultation, there's no consideration of ease of access of water sewer, and transportation and the impacts on other city services that that capacity building might entail. But I don't want to focus on that. I do want to focus a little bit more on some of the proposals we've had on how we can get more industrial sites ready for prime time to encourage more businesses to locate in Oregon, or as Business Oregon is focusing on now, to grow our own internal industry. If you recall in Metro's testimony on Monday about their industrial site readiness study, there are a number of reasons behind the limitation on large lots that currently exist. In 2013, the League worked with a number of interested parties on two bills that we think would help address these reasons that industrial lots aren't developing. First was Senate Bill 246, the Industrial Land Site Readiness Bill, which would allow a loan forgiveness program where the local resources are invested in creating either any of the local investments go towards any of the prohibitions on developing of the site and get repaid once the income taxes are seen from the industry that develops the site to fruition. In addition to that, there was Senate Bill 253, which we called the Due Diligence Assessment Bill, which would affect those areas outside of Metro to look around and see regionally what industrial sites are available and what are the impediments to developing those sites. Those bills passed with your support and I think are the basis for great programs that could help us decide why our lots aren't developing the way they need to and how we can put resources into those lots to make sure that they become quote unquote shovel ready. So when an industry comes knocking, we can say, I've got a lot to show you just down the street. Currently, those programs are unfunded, and we're hoping, I'm working with that same coalition that developed the programs to find funding for those bills in the Business Oregon budget. Secondly, the League is working with a similar but probably broader coalition of folks on brownfield cleanup. Brownfields are, of course, prevalent across the state, and more resources and tools are needed to address these vital industrial sites, which can be redeveloped and put land that was at one point industrial back into the property tax rolls and working for positive economic development. The three main components to that group's push this session have been creating local tools of a land banking set up by local governments to ensure that we can put these lands into a place where we know exactly what the costs are and mitigate those costs, and we do that at the local level with local resources. Or we can opt to develop a property tax abatement program for folks to abate their redevelopment costs. The second bill that we've worked on is a tax credit, which would be the state's pitch in on the investing in redevelopment of these sites. And third, of course, is the redevelopment fund that currently exists in budget or Business Oregon's special public works funds. All three of those tools are a piece to the puzzle of getting those properties back online, which I think can help address some of the industrial lands need. Third, the Infrastructure Finance Authority funds funding of a multitude of programs can help us create the infrastructure extensions to these industrial lands that can lead to the shovel-ready status. These are important because without infrastructure, the property is useless to an industrial user. In past sessions, we looked at the UGB expansion process, and we created a streamlined effect. Part of that conversation amongst stakeholders was a bill that would allow for expedited process, but required the coordination and cooperation of each level of government in that process. Due to time constraints and ongoing conversations about the UGB bill, which was far more necessary, I think we couldn't reach consensus between all the stakeholders, but I think that that consensus model is important first step in making sure that when we do have a business who says, I'm interested in coming to Oregon, we can say, we have a process that will serve you and find you the industrial land that you need to do the business that you want to bring into Oregon. But the cooperative piece that it was included in that is not included in Senate Bill 716. For large lot industrial in particular, we're also participating in the regionally significant site designation process throughout the state, which will create all these areas where we can invest in our industrial sites of varying sizes and bring in the industries and say, Oregon is open for business, and this is what we want, and this is how we will bring you in, and this is the places where we can provide you the infrastructure that you need and the employment that you need, and it's very important to this region to bring you here. In this session, there is House Bill 3147 that is now moving to the House floor. It passed out of committee yesterday that will require DLCD to examine the industrial site development process and report back to the legislature what is slowing down the process, if it's the land use system or is it beyond that, and how we can reduce those the time it takes to develop a property from bare land to fully ready for industry to move in. And then a final note that I would like to make regarding the reserves process in general. Reserves and UGBs are about projecting future need. They're not about finding lots that are readily available for turnaround tomorrow. A UGB represents 20 years of planned expansion. So when we say this is the edge of the UGB, that means this is as far as we can go in 20 years with our infrastructure dollars, and this is where we're going to be in 20 years to service the needs of our population as we expect it to grow. And then outside of that is something that will take longer than 20 years to get to. So by placing these large lots at the edge of the UGB, be it metros or cities in general, we're setting up a system where we're going to have to spend tons of money to extend infrastructure without being prepared to do so. Reserves and the reserves process was to develop 50 years worth of land need. We're not going to be able to turn around and site an industrial buyer in one of these lots in 5 years. These lots would be ready maybe at year 21 at best. And I would also point out, as has been pointed out, that this reserves process that took place in Metro in particular is still under review in Clackamas County because actually local governments had a problem with how the final product looked related to servicing infrastructure for a particular area within Clackamas County. And if we provide counties the ability to just simply redesignate at their own discretion without any local process, we further discourage the regional cooperation between the cities in Clackamas County and the county itself. So at this point, we believe that Senate Bill 716 is not ready. It's not the time. It's not needed. We need to invest in the programs that we've already developed to create more industrial lands that are shovel ready, that can bring industry in or expand the industry that we have. And for those reasons, we hope that you do not move 716 at this time. Thank you.
Thank you, all three of you. And I have a couple of questions for you. And I want to compliment the three of you. I think you, perhaps best articulated a summary of everything that I've heard against the bill, and so I appreciate the testimony of all three of you, although I share a little bit different perspective. But I do have some substantive questions, and I think that you could probably help me with some of them. So I asked for an opinion about what the process would be because I got the sense in the last hearing that if we pass this bill, boom, there goes public process, public input, stuff like that. So I asked for some analysis, and if this is incorrect, and I can always share it with you after the meeting, you can go through it, because I do want to know if the information that I've received is incorrect. I want to know that. I was told that first we would have LCDC would have to adopt rules to implement the bill. The rules would establish specific local procedures for a number of things. Step one. So first that would happen. Then there would be coordination with Metro, Port of Portland, Oregon Business Development Department, and DLCD. And coordination is a term of art in land use and requires exchanging information with affected government agencies. And secondly, consideration of concerns made by affected government agencies. The second step would be public notice. The third step would be public hearing before the County Board of Commissioners. The fourth step would be County Board of Commissioners' decision to designate a large lot industrial reserve. The fifth step, option to appeal the board decision. six-step, the large lot industrial reserve would be limited only, is limited to only rural level development until added to a UGB, which can only take place through the UGB expansion process, which happens every 6 years. And that process would require analysis of available land, projected population and employment growth, would also require considerations of factors and statutes and rules. Lands would be prioritized for inclusion based upon certain characteristics. If they are designated reserves, then there would be public hearings, then there would be a decision by Metro, then LCDC acknowledgement, then appeal to the Court of Appeals potentially, and then step seven would be annexation to a city, unless the county intended to plan and zone the large lot industrial reserve land for urban level uses, et cetera, et cetera. Step eight would be adoption of plan and zone map amendments consistent with standard procedures. Then, and that would involve notice to DLCD, public notice, multiple local hearings, determination by local governing body that plan and zone map amendments comply with statewide planning goals. Then there'd be post-adoption notice to DLCD, and then option to appeal to LUBA by those with standing. So that doesn't sound like a very expedited process, and so there's a piece of me that feels like the bill's pointless because it'll probably, I mean, talk about, and there's a lot of process and there's a lot of legal steps to go through. But I would, and I know you didn't hear it, you couldn't write fast enough, but you probably know the system inside and out. And so if any of this is incorrect, I would like to know that. I mean, seriously, I want to know that. And I just, other than I understand the negotiations and a deal is a deal and the political aspect of all of this, is any of that incorrect? And what would your response be?
Senator Edwards, members of the committee, Mary Kyle McCurdy, I heard a few things that I believe are incorrect, but okay. I'd be happy to read it.
I'll get you a copy.
A couple of things, as I heard them, were that there would be criteria to designate the lands. I'm not sure that's correct because okay. It's simply 150 to 500 acres. I'd want to look more at that. But a couple of issues on the inclusion of the land within the urban growth boundary. The bill requires an expedited process for including large lot industrial reserve within the UGB within 1 year after designation. So it's within 1 year. It's not every 6 years or whatever the other part of that was. And notwithstanding any provision of, I'm reading from the bill, notwithstanding any contrary provisions of a charter, an agreement, an urban services agreement, et cetera, without application of any land use laws, urban services must be provided to the large lot industrial reserve before the reserve is included within the UGB. There is nothing slow about either of those things, and they are definitely contrary to current processes. Also, once land is designated as an urban reserve, it goes to the top of the list for an urban growth boundary expansion. That hierarchy that you're familiar with is no longer applicable, or at least it is applicable, but the first thing in that hierarchy is urban reserves. So any city that has an urban reserve, and cities anywhere right now, any city can designate an urban reserve. In the metro area, they have this process that you've established that it has a coordinated urban and rural reserve process. However the urban reserve is designated, it's the first priority for UGB expansion. So whenever UGB expanded goes to that, regardless of the quality of the farmland. Those were just a few things that I heard. I think it's still undoing the multi-year process and policies that we've described. But I think it also isn't getting at what I think we've been talking about, the real need to bring existing industrial land into a ready state with investment in infrastructure and policies. And I think that we could all spend our time much better working on those kinds of financing and policy discussions and decisions that are hard, but they are absolutely necessary as the state of Oregon, Business Oregon can tell you, and I know this is an emphasis of the current Business Oregon, is we build jobs in Oregon and around the country one, two, and three at a time from existing businesses, mainly small businesses. And I think that's what we should be focusing on. But I would be happy to look at that and respond to anything else.
Okay. Offline, and I'd like to go through all that with you. So, thank you. Mr. Olson.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your testimony. Very enlightening. I've got a question for you. I was made aware of the rural reserves last year when I went to a CCBA meeting, and they put the map up there. And I was struck by the fact that it looked like the Great Wall of China for the north side of Clackamas County, which is my county. It looked like it just imperiled any ability of anybody south of that green rural reserve to develop. And I was very concerned about that because we have cities like Estacada and Malolo that want to expand and bring in industry in. You had mentioned many times, all of you did, about large lot, but this bill is dedicated towards large lot industrial reserve, which is 150 to 500 acres. So I'll ask you, and you probably don't know this, and I'm pretty certain that this chart is correct, but there really is no 150 to 5-acre large lot parcels on this map ready to go as you talk about. You talk about the large lot pieces, but there's one here at 472 acres, but it's marine use only. So we couldn't count on that. And there's 212, but it's a lease only and aviation use only. So we couldn't count on that. And those were in Multnomah County. And in Washington County, we had two. One was 270 acres, and it's an aggregate, but it's a wetland site. So probably couldn't work on that one either. And so we have one, Tigard Sand and Gravel, owns 12 parcels, 296.88 acres. Don't know if you've ever seen that, but it's kind of hilly and nasty. So the question I would ask is, if a large lot industrialist, I'm just going to speculate, Intel, Apple, Google, anybody huge wants to come in and wants to buy 150 acres. Now, see, what I look at, and the reason I looked at this bill was the fact that I'd like to see Canby, Oregon City, Happy Valley, Damascus, or something like that, be able to put this in, and not particularly where everybody thinks it's going to go, because, you know, that's what everybody thinks. But the fact is that what would we say to a large industry, which would bring great-paying jobs, that wants to come in here and says, I need 300 acres? How do we put that together, and what do we say? We just don't have it for you?
Chair Edwards, Senator Olson, I believe that there's staff here from Metro who can speak to that study exactly and let you know. But I think I don't want to answer the exact question of particular sites within the Metro area. Although I know on Monday you heard testimony from the city of Wilsonville that does have sites of those size, that they are in the process of making development ready over that size, as I recall. And we have redeveloped several gravel sites, Bridgeport Shopping Center being on one of them. But that is one of the sites. There's another mining aggregate site that I believe is in Wilsonville's that they're redeveloping right now. So those are possible. The particular sites Metro can speak to. The Metro Urban Rural Reserves, as I think you know, doesn't impact Estacada or Malala or Canby, although Estacada, I believe, designated an urban reserve. I'm not positive about that, but in any event, they can just a standalone urban reserve. So I'd defer to Metro on the site size issue, but I know that the city of Wilsonville did speak on Monday about sites they have of that size, and I'm pretty certain that Gresham has a letter in the record about their industrial sites that they are investing in to bring online that are in that neighborhood. But I, again, look at large sites that we've had. That one that I mentioned in Hillsboro in a single ownership was on the governor's site-ready certified list for years and sat undeveloped. We had a photo of it in our testimony of the for sale sign on it, and then it's been converted to smaller lots because that apparently is where the demand is for industrial sites, and that's where most of the job production is coming from. But I defer to Metro staff if you're going to have some more technical questions. I don't know if they can come up in this hearing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, the question is we really don't have that 150 to 500 acre site. That's the problem. We really don't have it. And if somebody wants to come in, they can't because they don't have it. the 90-acre site, you know, it's predicated, it's like selling a house. You have to have the right buyer at the right time at the right place. Everything has to be perfect to make it work. And we have a lot of, we do have a lot of industrial area, and we're not filling it. I'd like to see what we do, what I see on TV. I don't know if anybody else has ever seen it, but New York advertises out here. Saying they'll give us free property taxes, free corporate taxes, free income taxes if you come and invest, and because we have large sites. I'd like to see that. I'd like to see our state do that to bring in industry to our state. But, for example, Canby, the rural reserve is all the way around Canby. Is there? Yes, it is. I got a map right here, ma'am. I'm looking at it.
Oh, I know the.
There's no. There's a lady behind you.
Well.
Okay. Let's just. Okay.
Right. The question I was going to ask is, can we develop, improve or develop new roadways through the rural reserves? I've never really kind of got a straight answer to that, and I always wondered.
Chair Edwards, Senator Olson, the Clackamas County worked with the city of Canby, and that was Canby's request to have that particular area left for potential urban reserve in the Canby area for... I don't actually know what it is that Canby was considering doing with it, but that was an example of Canby and Clackamas County working together on that particular map designation.
My question was, can we develop new roads through rural reserves? Do you know that answer?
Chair Edwards, Senator Olson, right. It depends on the on whether there's an existing road there or not.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Good. Chair?
Yeah.
I mean, if we have one of these individuals looking for that site, I'll be glad to show them some sites in Douglas County.
But that's not this bill. They have any ice them.
Chair Edwards and Senator Olson, there's a 500-acre site in the city of Salem, the Mill Creek Industrial Site, they'd love to have some development on right now.
Thank you each for your testimony. Thanks. Then I do have some follow-up questions. We had a site selector here. I want to invite him back up because after the hearing, I had some questions. Let's see, where's his name?
What's the site selector?
Mr. Sheehy. So, and Russ Dondero also. Oh, okay, you're here. And you had signed up last time. When I called your name, you weren't here. So if you could go, Russ, and then I have some questions for Mr. Sheehy, and then we need to move on to our next hearings. So.
Thank you, Chair Edwards.
Yep.
And I had to leave because I had a previous commitment.
I understand.
At Pacific University, where I'm professor emeritus in political science. And I want to respond directly to Senator Prosansky's comment because I grew up in Roseburg in Douglas County. And I remember when timber was king, the jobs were in that county and the demographics of that whole region were. And it's not that way, as you know, today. So one of my major points in my testimony, which you have before you, and I'm just going to focus on that one point, was Oregon suffers, from my perspective, from a lopsided economic development growth model that privileges the metro area, especially Washington County, where I now live, over the other Oregon, quote-unquote, including my hometown, the county of Douglas County and Roseburg. We should focus on the rest of Oregon. So I would argue that this focus, the singular focus on the metro area, I think is presenting us with a future that we don't want or should think about secondly. If we want to replicate what's happened in the Bay Area, where people have to drive 40 and 80 miles for affordable housing to their work sites in Palo Alto, Menlo Park, at San Jose, we are going to create in the metro area an even worse housing problem we already have now. As someone who spends a lot of time on housing issues, affordable housing issues, I don't think that's good planning. So I echo what my friend and college mate, Steve Cafori, said earlier about good planning. To me, 716 is flawed because it's not good planning. The questions you're all asking are great questions, but this is not the answer to your good questions, in my opinion. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Sheehy, I have a couple of questions I wrote down after you testified early in the hearing, and frankly, I didn't hear some of what you said because I was still arranging with committee staff who was testifying when, because we'd started late because the House or the Senate floor session went over and everything. So I wrote down some questions. You had mentioned that You mentioned a couple of opportunities lost, as well as an inability to show Oregon as well to clients. Can you expand on that a little bit more about, you know, a scenario where businesses are looking at potential locations, what they're looking for, and how, in your experience as a site selector or consultant, or I'm not exactly sure what your title is, but how does Oregon fare?
Sure. Yeah, thank you, Senator Edwards and members of the committee. My name is Dick Sheehy. I live in Beaverton, Oregon, and do run a site selection consulting group for Siege Tuam Hill in Portland, and we help companies find new sites all over the world. And occasionally, Oregon's on the list. We certainly show that. Haven't been down to Douglas County too many times, but have looked at a couple properties there. Maybe one example that maybe stepped through, I think will answer a lot of questions and kind of give everybody my view as far as an Oregonian and as far as how we stack up around the country and around the world. Summer of 2013, we had a large industrial user manufacturer, very large investment, multiple state investigation, and it was exceeding 100 acres is what they wanted. Power was a very, very important thing, not only quality power, but potential green power. So the Northwest was on the list. When we looked at the inventory, and I know there's over 7,000 acres of industrial property in the Portland metro area, there's only one site that made the long list, and that was the Gresham Business Park. Due to several factors, as we move forward, that site was eliminated, partially because it wasn't the right size, wasn't the right shape. There were proximity on the edges that were not really compatible with the property, so, or with the development, and speed to get underway and begin construction. We had an argument with the company that because it was inside the urban growth boundary, they couldn't do this project faster anywhere else. But that's still a struggle to convince a company that when some places around the country don't have any process to go through. So that, from a sense, I think the urban growth boundary is good. What happened, the company went elsewhere. But I think the fallout from that, and this is high-tech manufacturing, because of I would almost guarantee that the company still thinks there's only one site in Oregon that's potentially available. And it meets some requirements, doesn't meet others. Not all requirements are the same. This company currently is investigating three other similar type investments around the world. They're not readily fit for an Oregon, so they didn't even make the long list to begin with. But that's really how it goes. We create process. That was 2 years ago. I think if we had had 716 then, taking a look at it, and there was a process started to develop some alternative sites, the successful states around the country are currently, like you said, New York, is currently marketing themselves. They take sites, they get them ready, and they promote them to these companies that are building facilities. So that would be something that Business Oregon, states, communities, whoever wanted to move forward on those type issues could identify how they could make a site ready, could be marketing the state and changing perception. I mean, Governor McCall said, come but don't stay, and I think we've done a lot to get around that, or not really get around it, but change that perception. But I think we're kind of getting that perception again. We really are not open for business. So,
okay. Follow-up question that I had was, you touched on one of my follow-up questions, what some other states are doing. I'd like your thoughts, as somebody that does what you do, about site aggregation. We heard a lot about that. And you know, we heard a lot of testimony last hearing about how there are plenty of sites, but they need to be aggregated. What's your perspective on that?
It's a viable alternative, and many locations do it. I think they do it when there's a lot of demand that really is driving a lot of activity. We tend to not have that much demand here in the state for large sites, but when we do, there's reasons they want to come here and reasons they would be here. Site aggregation, in my experience, only works when it's driven by a common vision of all the property owners, a common vision by the local governments of what they want to do and how they want to do it. Somehow they get control of the property so they can deliver it. They do a lot of planning. They do a lot of engineering, figure out how they're going to serve it, and up through sometimes even fund the infrastructure. Maybe not all that way, but there's a lot of work that has to be done, and it's always driven by the local governments, in my opinion, the ones that have been successful. And I've seen those, but a lot of them also occur at the edge of development where you only have to work with one or two owners. Working with 5 or 6 or 10 or 15 owners on an aggregation, all you need is one holdout, and it can mess up the whole project. And the real message there is there's not a company anywhere that will go through that. That has to be done prior to deliver the package and make it readily available in a ready site.
Okay. Are you familiar with Coffee Creek? There's quite a number of comments about Coffee Creek and
right.
the sites that are already in Wilsonville.
Right. I'm somewhat familiar with it. I've never looked at it as far as an industrial site based on my site selection experience or real estate experience. I was in the industrial real estate in Portland market in the early 80s when we needed jobs because of the shift in timber employment. Actually, one of my colleagues bought some property in Coffee Creek with the intention of it would be a good industrial site in the future as things developed and grew. Nothing happened, and that was 35 years ago. So as far as I know, I've never shown it, and it still is a lot of small lots, and there's no real vision as far as moving forward, or I don't know what's been done, but I really don't have any knowledge on that. But when I look for sites in the Portland metro area for a company that's coming in, it's never come up on the radar screen.
Okay. And then we also heard a lot about the quantity of industrial land and the need for infrastructure to serve those sites. How do you view that infrastructure question? Is that all that you need? What are your perspectives? Are infrastructure improvements, do they make all sites work, basically? I mean, is a site, as long as there's infrastructure to it?
No, they're not. Infrastructure is a critical piece, but each particular manufacturing, traded sector type manufacturing facility has different needs. One may be driven by power, like the one 2 years ago that looked at Gresham. One may be driven more by water. One may be driven more by technology, workforce. So we have a lot of those things here. So infrastructure is really both a quality but also a timing issue. You have to have the right infrastructure. Company has to believe that the infrastructure will be there when they turn the lights on. So it's very important, but all the different qualities of a site really depend on what that requirement is. It can be all over the board. Like I said, for this one requirement, the Gresham Business Park didn't work for various reasons. It had probably some of the best infrastructure in the state as far as power and water, and the city of Gresham was very, very helpful in putting the package together to show them that it could work. But didn't work for various reasons. So it's very, very important. It has to be there. But there are other characteristics of sites that really drive the final decision.
So my last question is, in your opinion, do we have the right site available to support the next semiconductor manufacturer or, high-tech venture that is, traded sector, it's an anchor business? Does that exist?
Well, I think as Senator Olson has said, it does not. And I've been asked that question by several companies over the last couple of years. Does Oregon have those kind of sites? Should we look there? And the answer has been no. That's what I have to tell them because it's true.
Thank you. That's all of my questions.
I have a question. When and Senator Edwards talked about aggregation of sites, when a prospective tenant comes in and they see a site that could be aggregated, what is their concern if it's filled with unoccupied buildings or preoccupied or occupied buildings? Do they have a concern that they'll have to tear that down? Is that, does that factor into whether they would look at the site or not look at the site?
Yeah, it does. It's an issue that they have to address. It's a risk issue. What's there, what's been there. Risk is a big driver for these companies today. So it's also a timing issue. How fast can I get it done, and will it slow things down, or will there be issues with the demo? It's a concern. So that would be one black mark against the site.
Follow up? Yeah. Because we've heard oftentimes that we need to develop these sites. Now, from the field that I'm in, development would be predicated on the consumer, what's going to be there. Mm-hmm. And if you develop it and, say, put in a 12-inch sewer line and the facility coming in needs a 20-inch sewer line, mm-hmm. the development, it's a fail sale because it doesn't meet the requirement. So does the development of the infrastructure need to come before, during, or after a customer says, I want that project or I want that property?
Senator Olson, very good question. Some places and some competition will put in the infrastructure prior to the company coming. Those have very targeted industries. They basically know what the community wants and what their chances of success are. So they may have to do that. That's a real shotgun approach, and it's very dangerous and can be very expensive. A lot of communities will do the planning, have some flexibility in infrastructure, have the engineering done. What we like to say is they spend all the money except hard money to actually put it in. Then they have a schedule, they have right-of-ways, they have everything, so they can at least talk with me and a client and say, this is exactly how long it's going to take us to put that infrastructure in to make it right for you. Sometimes companies are okay with that. Sometimes they're not even okay with that. But if you don't have all that done, and that really comes with an aggregation situation too, there's a lot more work before you even get to the infrastructure. It's very difficult for a company to say that's a ready site, ready to go.
Final question.
Yeah, last question.
Thank you. We heard some testimony talking about, you know, the Tri-County area gets the bulk of all the fruit, and mm-hmm. everybody else kind of suffers. Do most companies that are looking for this type of product, these large lot industrial reserves, do they look more to metro, or would they prefer to be in like a Salem or a Roseburg? Does that fit their needs, or do they like that the community atmosphere that we provide in the Tri-County area?
A lot of the companies, especially in the high technology area, perhaps coming out of California or what they've been used to, want to be close to the metro area. It's just bottom line. Sometimes the initial criteria they will give us is 30, 45, or an hour from PDX. So that makes our line pretty quick. However, there's some companies that prefer to be what we call a bigger fish in a smaller pond. They don't want to compete with the large employers in Portland. They have similar businesses. Those people are more prime or maybe likely to go to a Salem or Eugene, Medford type thing. It still gets to be access, and airports are important because these kind of manufacturing facilities have visitors all the time. And so getting in and out is a big criteria that, once again, then tends to drive it back up to the metro area. So it's difficult on rural Oregon, and I don't know what the solution is. I grew up in Baker, and it's a long ways from the valley, and it's a long ways from the valley.
Geography, thank you.
Thank you for being here and answering the follow-up questions.
Mm-hmm.
Questions? Senator Przonski, you have any questions?
I do not.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
That concludes the public hearing on Senate Bill 716. I'm closing the public hearing on Senate Bill 716, and we are moving on the agenda. Okay. We're next going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 125. Beth, could you tell us a little bit about what the bill does, and we'll call forward. I think we have some senators here to testify on the bill. Senator Hansel, Senator Farioli, Is that it as far as, okay.
Chair and committee members, Senate Bill 125 requires ODFNW to take certain actions prior to expanding or adopting a new program or expanding an existing program. There's a dash one amendment on OLIS that removes the requirements that notification be limited to those people that have been impacted financially and clarifies that the analysis of the program should anticipate economic, ecological, and social costs.
Go ahead. Rock, paper, scissors. Or you've already worked it out. Okay.
Senator Edwards, members of the committee, for the record, Bill Hansel is my name, state senator for District 29, located in Eastern Oregon. Senate Bill 125 comes to you for your consideration as a direct result of actions taken by ODFNW staff in circumventing any review or input from the ODFNW Commission on a very important policy last year. To me, this was a violation of transparency and why we have citizen commissions and boards for most of our state departments and agencies. The issue came to my attention in the summer of 2014 when the ODFNW director and some staff made a presentation before the Northwest Power Planning and Conservation Council on a proposal to increase the spill over the Snake and Columbia River dams for fish. I was told no stakeholders were brought into their discussion prior to the proposal and its presentation. But what bothered me the most was the complete lack of involvement with the ODFNW Commission. Chair Bobby Levy stated she first learned about it when she read about it in a local newspaper. This prompted me, along with Senator Farioli, to appear before the Commission in Salem in their September 2014 meeting. This governor-appointed and Senate-confirmed body of citizens reaffirmed that they had not been included in any discussion and they would have wanted to be involved in such an important policy decision. Then, less than a month later, again with no commission involvement, ODFNW entered into a lawsuit along with the state against the Northwest Power Planning and Conservation Council asking for additional spill into the rivers. Thus far, ODFNW, I was told at a hearing when I asked the question, spent over $50,000 in this lawsuit, and it is far from finished. Senate Bill 125 would require the agency to bring before their commission these kinds of policy decisions for discussion and vetting before such an action is taken. Many of us are tired of the disregard for the citizen board and circumventing a transparent and open process. Jim Myron from the Wild Fish Society has worked with my office on some amendments, and we have agreed to several that would make Senate Bill 125 better. I also want to state I serve on the Natural Resources Subcommittee of Ways and Means. On Monday of the week, I asked Director Byler from the Water Resources Department what he takes before his Water Resources Commission, and his basic reply was, well, about everything, including budgets and policy decisions. I firmly believe the citizens of Oregon and the Oregon legislature would be better served if ODFNW had the same practice, and Senate Bill 125, I believe, will accomplish this goal. I urge your support, and I would be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you for laying the issue out. Senator Farioli.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Despite my admonition to the good senator that if I testified in favor of his bill, it would kill it, he invited me here today.
Definitely puts it at risk. I was joking.
Yeah, of course you were, sir. So was I.
So we're clear.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife is a wholly unique organization. And the commission structure is a unique commission structure. In fact, they have the unique authority to hire their director. The director is not appointed by the governor, as many of our boards and commissioners. And that means that there is the expectation that the commission itself will more thoroughly manage the affairs of the Department of Fish and Wildlife, which touches literally the lives of every citizen in the state of Oregon, whether you are a non-consumptive consumer of wildlife activities like bird watching or whale watching or just enjoying the outdoors, or you are a hunter, fisher, or other member of the public that uses a consumptive mechanism to experience wildlife. Bottom line is all of us are affected. This commission really is responsible to all Oregonians. To have a policy set by middle managers reduced to writing and then submitted as official input to the Bonneville Power Administration and other key decision makers about power policy and dam management, when half of the state is dependent on public power provided by Bonneville Power Administration, to me is just unthinkable. The whole idea of the board and commission is to provide a venue like this committee to vet different ideas, to listen to proposals, to have those debated, you know, in the open. As a matter of fact, Oregon's sunshine laws are world-renowned for trying to get us to that very place where information is transparently shared with others and people are invited into the conversation and not necessarily a debate. Senate Bill 125 does that very specifically for this agency. If you look at the bill, it's one page. It talks about creating an obligation for the agency when it changes or implements a brand new program, that it will vet these ideas before the commission, it will invite the communities to participate, it will do outreach for information, and it will take the information and make it available in a transparent manner. If this bill were in place, it would not have been possible for a middle manager, a middle-level executive within the department to create a policy as important as management of the spill over the Columbia River system outside the purview of the commission members and submit it as an official document with the imprimatur of the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. This is a change that I think could really be valuable, not only for this agency, but when this demonstrates that it works, perhaps other agencies would use it as a model as well. I think the concept is a great concept. I hope the bill passes, which is why my name is not on the bill. So we commend it to your good offices, Mr. Chair and members of the committee.
Thank you both. Questions for the senators? Yeah, Senator
Thank Denver. You. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the issue of the spill came up last year. We had a hearing on it, and it, you know, I think that it gave the committee the opportunity to ask some tough questions of the agency, which I thought were productive, but, you know, perhaps it didn't stop a practice from happening that did, but that's I don't really know the details of the case. I do definitely agree with the senator that Senator Hansel that we want to have our public commissions, you know, really being the sort of sounding boards, reality checks. I use that term for agencies when they are proposing new programs and trying out new programs. I do appreciate the intent behind this bill. The one concern that I have, and I mentioned it to Senator Hansel, is just how you define what a new program is, or even more to the point, the expansion of an existing program, because you know you can certainly imagine some minor expansions that you know maybe don't rise to that level. I think, you know, from my experience, it's always a good idea to err on the side of openness with the commission, you know, just throwing out ideas to them and get them involved early on. But I am a little concerned about, like, what would the trigger be before somebody would bring down the hammer of this new statute.
I agree with you, or Chair Edwards, Senator Denbrough. I agree with you. I guess from what we're seeing with other departments, when in doubt, go before the board. I mean, if it's an issue, and why would that even be a decision necessarily? I mean, if you have vetted it, or if you're going to vet it, I would rather err on the side of caution. Make sure that you've got the input. I think a prudent manager would do that.
and get the guidelines and move forward. I hope it isn't a showstopper. I think it can be worked out, and that would be between the commission and the director. If I was the chair of the commission and there were particular things I wanted to make sure that they brought before the board, I could sit down and say, these are what we want to hear. These, you have the discretion. I mean, work that out internally, but to set the framework within which that discussion could be held.
And Mr. Chair, if yes. I could respond to the good senator's inquiry. I would really like to commend the senator for looking beyond the issue of the spill. The issue isn't the spill. It could have been any of the issues where a number of folks had potential for an impact, either negative or positive. So, you know, the idea that this issue of the spill is central to the question, it really isn't. The question is whether or not the board manages the agency or the agency is engaged in the care and feeding of the board. And the fact is, this agency is so unique, the board runs the agency. You know, not the employees of the agency set the agenda, make the proposals for what's heard, perhaps only offer the board a non-choice of here's the proposal that we're making and you can rubber stamp it or we'll argue. You know, that is not the way the commission is supposed to operate. And there's been a history perhaps where the commission has only been given a single option or not even involved. So this bill will add a level of requirement for transparency and engagement that doesn't currently exist. So thank you, Senator Dambrough, for looking beyond the issue of the spill. This is how this organization, I believe, was meant to run. It's supposed to be a sounding board, and the ultimate deciders are the commission members, and they instruct the director and the staff of the commission to implement. That is the proper, I think, the appropriate relationship, and I don't think that's always been the case at the Department of Fish and Wildlife.
So if the commission has hiring authority over the director, does it also have firing authority?
It does.
And hence, it seems like it, the director should be listening to the commission if he or she wants to keep their job. And so I'm wondering, did the commission make its displeasure clear to the director? And if the director didn't know about it, probably he should have known about it. And, you know, I mean, perhaps there was, a way that the board could have managed this issue itself, as opposed to coming to the legislature for a fix.
Mr. Chairman, I can't speculate, but Mr. Chair and to Senator Dambrough, the director under whose authority. Management authority, who was director during which time the letter was written, took another opportunity in a federal agency outside of the commission's purview, and that we wish him well. He's, there's nothing pejorative about getting a promotion. He moved to a different agency, and the person who is now in the director's model, who is now in the director's role, really has been there only a short period of time. But I think we've tried to make clear that the education of the board and the role and responsibilities that the board really needs to exercise is slightly different than the historic role they've played. So we're looking for the board to really step up their game and get much more engaged in the operations and management of the agency so that we get better outcomes. So I will put part of the responsibility for the situations that occurred on corporate culture of the agency. So for many years we've had an agency that really was working with the board not on an advise and consent basis, but sort of on a this is what we're going to do, and we want the board's support for this action. We're the experts. You know, we're the ones with the wildlife biology credentials, and you're just lay people. Well, you know, Oregon's boards and commissions fill a very unique role. The state simply couldn't run without them. We want lay people in these roles because they're more practical sometimes than folks that have the expert status. Bottom line is this bill, I think, will move that board into the sunlight and require them to ask the questions about, hey, is this a new program? Or is this an expansion of the program? And is it something the board should get engaged with? And more often than not, I think the answer ought to be yes.
Senator Olson, and then we can move on.
I hate to be the worm in your apple pie, but I want to ask a question for clarification. If I requested ODFW to do a bass count on 10 Mile Lake, would this be an expansion to carry out the thing? Would we need to go through this process to do a fish count on a lake? Or could that be excluded from this? I can understand the overall concept of this is why it's there, but I just want to make sure that the little programs that we do, that they do every day, don't fall under this threshold that every time they want to count fish or do a lake census or electroshock, that it's a program or an expansion of a program that they're going to have to do an advisory committee to talk about it and scientific, because if you bring in a scientific program, a scientific review, then it's going to have a fiscal on it. So I just wondered what your explanation is there.
Mr. Chairman, to Senator Olson, if the senator suggests that a bass count during the legislative session, during budget hearings, is an important aspect of the mission of the department, I can nearly guarantee you that that bass count will be conducted. Now, if you're asking if a citizen comes up and simply says, hey, I think we ought to do a bass count on 10 Mile Lake, they write a letter to the commission, and the commission staff should present that request to the commission, which would stimulate a debate or a question, an issue for the commission to decide, is it a new project? Is it a mission that we're already doing because they do fish counts? And when is the next scheduled bass count for 10 Mile Lake scheduled? And I think that's the way they arrive at an answer. This isn't meant to over-bureaucratize the agency. It's meant to stimulate conversations that the board needs to be engaged in. Do you want a bass count on 10 Mile Lake?
No. Follow up. I'm just concerned that there's normal functional things they do day in and day out. And if they were to do an additional count of coyotes or wolves or something, that they would fall under this auspices and then have to get the review and all of this stuff. Is that, I know that's not your intent.
Not the intent.
Not the intent, Senator Edwards. Senator, that's not the intent at all. And so, no, I would hope that would not be a result of this bill at all.
So we'd leave it up to the board to do what the board is supposed to do.
And encourage the board to be more engaged, more open, more transparent.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you both. We're going to leave this public hearing open. We have Senator Roblin here to kick off a public hearing on Senate Bill 803. So we're going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 803. And then we will toggle back to Senate Bill 125 after Senator Roblin's testimony on Senate Bill 803.
Chair Edwards and committee, it's great to be here again. I'm here about Senate Bill 803. I'm State Senator Arnie Rehoblin. I've been over in the House a little while ago. From District 5, for the record. 803 has been in process for about three or four years. And it comes from conversations that a number of people have had that really goes back to 15 or 20 years when we used to have Oraqua fish hatchery out on the North Spit where it was a private business and they let fish out and they swam around in the Pacific Ocean and they came back home to Coos Bay and we had this big Springer fishing derby right outside of the place where the fish would swim back in to be used in the commercial business, and there was a lot of happening in Coos County when that particular business was going on, and then that business left and the fish, because spring salmon do not live in Coos Bay because we don't have a glacial-fed river, and that's where springers come from. So it's a terminal fishery. They swam around there till they either died or got caught, and that's what happened with them. There's not been much evidence that they stray very often, and they'd have to stray a ways. They're not going to go down to the Rogue or some of the other places. But we have tried very hard to figure out, is there a way to get that fishery back? Sorry about this one. If you find me, I'll take the fine.
You got to get milk on the way home.
I know. That's my daughter, actually. I'll talk to her later. So all of a sudden, a group of people who want to start their own little hatchery thing in Coos Bay with springers and bring that fishery back. We have an amazing fishery in the fall right now. It changes Coos Bay. You have people on the boardwalk along the bay casting and fishing with their families off the beach. I mean, it's really kind of fun to watch because the program that we've had on Coos River has really produced a lot of salmon, and they come in, they get ready to go up the river. But this is not that kind of fishery. This is a smaller fishery, and when we were having the conversations on the coast this last couple of years about the multi-species plan, one of the conversations came up from Fish and Wildlife that we could maybe put this fishery in Coos Bay and in Yaquina Bay up at Tillamook, up at Newport, because neither of them have rivers where these fish are going to survive and go up and spawn. It isn't going to happen. So they're not going to mix with the native fish. Originally in the plan, the Fish and Wildlife was going to come up with the money for these pens. The STEP program that would have to be formed around it would have to take care of it after that and raise money. And in the future, it's only this first couple year expense that was actually going to be there. It was in their budget, and then that got taken out, so they made a little pop for it. The governor did away with that, and as I have some constituents, I actually said, let's put the bill in and see what happened. It's about $375,000. It's about buying some net pens because you get these smolts from a hatchery somewhere, and then you bring them to Coos Bay. We're talking about $100,000 in each, not big numbers. You raise them in the pen for a couple of weeks to acclimate them, and then off they go. And then a few years later, they swim back a bit larger, we hope. And we have a new fishery that's starting in the bay to bring tourists and others and to local people to catch in the bay again. And we believe that actually when the pens are, that'll also be a opportunity for local people to get involved and kids, which we've done with all of our hatcheries, but to feed them and do things. But also for tourists that come and say, what's that out in the bay right there by this part, or that's wherever we find a place to put them? And we'll say, well, that's little salmon growing up in Coos Bay. We have probably with our fall run, we probably have the best hatchery education program of any place, I believe, in the West Coast. Hundreds and hundreds of elementary kids are up clipping fins. They come back, and when the fish are coming in and collect them, it's pretty an exciting thing to watch these kids get engaged with this fishery and to get excited about these fish of Oregon. We didn't know of any other way to get this startup money. We expect that after that, we're going to take care of it ourselves and do things. The STEP group will raise money. They'll get newer people that get engaged, and this will be something that will go on for a long time and hopefully encourage a few more fish so that we have a bigger return in the future. So I would encourage your thoughtful consideration of this bill.
Thank you, Senator.
Questions Roland. I would love to answer from anybody else.
Can I ask a question?
I would never deny you the opportunity to ask a question, but I would suggest that you keep it brief.
It will be brief. I actually knew a couple fisheries biologists that worked for that fish plant down there. One of their concerns was that we had trawlers come in and they were picking off their fish. The question I'm asking you is, will this expand your charter fishery and help your charter fishery?
We would hope that it would in that area. Since they're going to come there, they'll be coming into the bay. There is a possibility that the charter will start taking advantage of it. I know they took advantage of it in the past. And what's nice is it's a base fishery for a lot of people. So it's right in the bay, not out in the ocean, which makes it available to a lot of other people. But the charters will take advantage of whatever's there. And if people are coming and the fish are there, they'll find a way to be a part of that.
Yeah, follow up. Could you mention the two areas where it's going to be?
Tillamook Bay and Coos Bay.
I'm pretty far apart.
Yaquina Bay. I always say Tillamook.
Big fishery.
It's Yaquina Bay, Newport.
Oh, excellent. Excellent.
Newport.
Yeah, the seals are getting a little thin there.
Yeah. Newport and Coos Bay. Yeah.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. So we're going to go back to Representative McCune here. So we're going to go back to Senate Bill 125, and I'm going to ask that you try to be sensitive to our time. We're going to have two panels. I'd ask that you each keep it to 2 minutes because we've got this bill and then we've got four more bills to do after it. So, this is just first public hearing. So I'm going to call up Tom Wolf and Jim Myron and Jonathan Manton. And on deck will be Ted Case, Beth Vargas Duncan, and Marianne Nash, and Steve Eldridge.
Senator Edwards, for the record, my name is Tom Wolf, Executive Director of the Oregon Council of Trout Unlimited. You already have my testimony in OLIS. Hope you get a chance to read it. Trout Unlimited reluctantly opposes this bill because we recognize the sentiment behind it. We believe that the bill itself creates a process that shouldn't need to exist. What we would suggest is that they work with ODFW Commission to try to make the process more transparent. And let me close with, I have been testifying and working with ODFW for 25 years. I've testified more. I've sat on more panels. Nobody recognizes that there's a problem with transparency at ODFW like I do. So I understand and sympathize with the proponents of this bill. This bill, though, is just the wrong approach. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Jim.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jim Myron. I'm here representing the Native Fish Society. And when we first saw this bill in early February, we thought that there were some interesting concepts there that we wanted to work with. That's why we contacted Senator Hansel's office and offered up some proposed amendments. Some of them were incorporated into an amendment that may or may not be before you today. But a couple of the ideas that we really think should be part of the process at ODFW is, you know, notification certainly is important, so notifying, you know, interested parties or affected parties when a new program is proposed or a program is changed is important. Also, we like the idea of having some sort of cost analysis of some of these programs. The problem is the bill as written would apply to all new programs and all changes to existing programs. I think that's an overreach and creates a huge fiscal burden and a huge bureaucratic nightmare. So if we could find a way to limit that to just certain new programs that should have a cost analysis and maybe an outside scientific review, we support those kinds of things, and we would like to see that. And hopefully there's time to use this vehicle to do something like that, because that, in the long term, that would be very helpful. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Edwards and members of the committee. My name is Jonathan Manton. I'm here testifying today on behalf of Water Watch. Share some of the most of the sentiments that have just been expressed. We're opposed to the bill, even as amended, though certainly would favor the transparency and engagement for the public that's needed. The testimony that we have on OLIS is to the bill itself. It's not to the amendment, so I would note there's a few changes. And just very quickly, like, some of the language in the bill that gives us problems are with the advisory committee that's listed in line 13B. They would be assisting in all aspects of developing the proposed new or expanded program. You basically have folks who are adversely affected then, you know, developing the program as compared to the agency developing the program in accordance with its mission. It also asks for the cost-benefit analysis, and I appreciate the amended version of that analysis to include social and ecological considerations, but it's not considering future generations. And again, the mission of this agency is not just for all Oregonians now, but it's to manage the and the exact language is protect and enhance Oregon's fish and wildlife and their habitats for use and enjoyment by present and future generations. Those cost-benefit analyses don't usually take into account future generations. Finally, contracting for outside science. Concerns about the role of agency scientists, and we're trying to protect the agency biologists. And I think there may be some weird conflict with going to outside scientists when we would support a public process that's considering and engaging the agency scientists. And with that, I'll just close and say thanks.
Thank you. Questions for the panelists? Thank you each.
Thanks.
And now Steve Eldridge and Ted Case, Beth Vargas Duncan, and Marianne Nash. Again, encourage each of you to keep it to 2 minutes if you can.
Chair Edwards, members of the committee, my name is Marianne Nash. I'm the Public Policy Counsel for the Oregon Farm Bureau. I will be much less than 2 minutes. Just wanted to say I'm here today in support of the bill. We think it supports increased transparency within the agency and is definitely a step in the right direction toward ensuring that the public's well informed of the decisions the agencies are making.
Thank you, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Steve Eldridge. I'm the General Manager and CEO of Umatil Electric Cooperative in Hermiston, Oregon. I report to a seven-member board, and I'm here to support Senate Bill 125. Our support of this bill and the reason for the bill stems from the concerns about the failure of the Department of Fish and Wildlife in its handling of a proposal to engage in a 10-year spill test on the Snake and Columbia River dams, an experiment which would have cost Umatil Electric Cooperative and our members $1 million per year over the course of the experiment, experiment we were very lucky to find out about, despite the lack of transparency and outreach of ODFNW. This is not a new phenomena at ODFNW. They are known for unilateral decisions, the only state in the Northwest that continues to sue NIMS and the biological opinion, changing water quality standards. I mean, this is a long history that they have. ODFNW failed to provide transparency in its actions, failed to include or even inform stakeholders apart from those few who supported the proposal, failed to take into account the potential economic impact on parties in the region, failed to include other state agencies and the BPA in its process, failed to engage in due diligence regarding to the scientific evaluation. In fact, when they presented it to the Northwest Power Planning Council, the Independent Science Board, said that they could not support it. It was not ready for prime time. So when there was scientific review, it was not supported. They failed to clearly articulate goals for the planned experiment and finally failed to inform their commission about their activities on this project until legislators found out about it and held a hearing on the issue. Senate Bill 125 is designed to make sure that in the future, the Department of Fish and Wildlife takes the steps it should have taken regarding the spill test experiment. And I think that passing this bill reinforces to the commission what their duties are and if they have the support of the legislature to follow through. In addition, it places in statute the kind of actions we already expect. Mm-hmm. We expect them to work with communities and stakeholders to be transparent. In fact, even the advocates in the previous panel, they support the transparency, but they don't want to put it in statute. It's unfortunate that such legislation is necessary, but it is better for the legislature to have the opportunity to make expectations clear rather than allow a few agency actions to undermine the public faith that they are operating openly, transparently, and with objective external means of evaluating. To their credit, the ODFNW Commission, once this was raised to their attention, did act and made an effort, and the passage of this legislation doesn't deal with the underlying issue that we see particularly in this agency, and that is agencies setting state policy. Unelected people, we want you to set the state policy, and then they implement that policy. Thank you very much. We are in support of Senate Bill 125, and I appreciate any questions you have.
Thank you.
Chair Edwards, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ted Case. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Rural Electric Cooperative Association, represents 18 electric cooperatives in the state. I think the senators and Mr. Eldridge articulated the issue very well, and I want to associate myself with their remarks. When a proposal like this bill proposal costs Oregonians $1 billion over 10 years, it should be fully vetted. When a proposal like this bill plan fail scientific scrutiny and actually would hurt fish and kill fish, it should be fully considered. It was not. This legislation, I commend Senator Hansel for putting it forward, would bring this type of decision-making out of the shadows and receive full vetting. So I fully support it and urge you to pass it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Edwards, members of the committee. I'm Beth Vargas Duncan, Executive Director of Oregon Municipal Electric Utilities Association. We have 11 municipal electric utilities statewide. I'm here to also speak in support of Senate Bill 125 and thank Senator Hansel for bringing forth this legislation. We, too, are very concerned about the stark example brought forward under the spill issue that's already been discussed. The costs have already been discussed. I do want to mention that in a meeting with members of my board and myself, ODF&W staff admitted they were uncertain of the outcome of the experiment and that it could indeed kill fish. I think when things are this uncertain, this costly, and when we are the only ones in the region and other states and tribes have agreed to collaborate along with the federal agencies, I reference you to Terry Flores. She's the director of River Partners. She also submitted testimony and unfortunately was not able to be here today, but I ask you to refer to that. That's also been submitted. But I also want to mention that Bonneville Power Administration, our ratepayers, contribute heavily into the Fish and Wildlife Program. In 2014, we ratepayers contributed $464 million in 1 year for direct programs to fish and wildlife. Since 1978, we provided $14.6 billion to add more experiments. And costly litigation on top of this is something to be widely considered and does come to the level of definitely a department's commission and the state legislature when the commission and department are not functioning as they should. So that's why we are here today. We ask for your support of this legislation, and we're seeking a opportunity for a catalyst for change. Everyone that has testified has acknowledged that greater transparency would be beneficial. So we ask for your support. Thank you.
Thank you.
Brief
question. On line 9, it says that the earliest opportunity to give notice to persons likely to be adversely impacted. How would you define that, and how would you find them all? If anyone can answer.
I think that they know who will be adversely impacted. That's why they're not talking to them now. And who's paying the bill? That's one group. Who's affected by it?
This is the water spill, but any ODFW program that they're putting on, how would they know who those people were? Like I talked about earlier, they want to count bass. How would they know who is likely to be affected by that?
Well, if it's a transparent announcement, the people that have a concern about will have an opportunity to make themselves known.
Okay.
Any other questions? Thank you each for being here.
Thank you.
So that wraps up everybody that signed up on Senate Bill 125. So we are going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 125. We still have the hearing open on Senate Bill 803. That was the one that Senator Roblin had about spring Chinook fishery. Senator Bearshiger is here to kick off. So we're just going to kind of leapfrog down the list here. So we're going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 846. Senator Bearshiger, and Senate Bill, we are also opening up a public hearing on Senate Bill 847. If you could kick off these couple of bills, 803 is still open, then we'll go back to that after Senator Bearshiger's testimony. And we're doing the best we can, so.
Thank you, Chair Edwards, members of the committee. For the record, my name's Herman Bearshiger, Oregon State Senator, District 2. Senate Bill 846, want to start on that first?
Sure.
Okay. 846, so it's basically a task force. So, you know, we've done a real good job enhancing our fisheries for salmon, and but one of the problems that we've gotten into are on these small tributaries, or they could be irrigation ditches or drainage ditches. So we do a set of rules protecting salmon and smolt and all that. But yet, sometimes it's not just the natural tributaries. It's man-made ditches, or it can be tributaries that have been converted in one way or another over the last 100 years. And so we run into these conflicts with farmers, irrigation districts, drainage districts, and things like that. So I thought it would be prudent of us, as instead of trying to paint a rule for all these waterways, that we look at the different waterways. So we have the natural, converted, and maybe man-made. And so how we can achieve the goals of those, the man-made ditches or the converted waterways, how we can achieve goals to both benefit the agriculture users, the drainage ditch districts, so that we can, we don't have to go through these this process of having to contact Division of State Lands or Fish and Wildlife. Can we address these as three different ways instead of just one and trying to achieve all the goals of those waterways? And that's basically, this is a task force that will be looking at those issues and how to address them concerning those types of waterways.
All right. Any questions for Senator on 846? Okay. Why don't you give us the overview and the make the case for 847 as well, and then I think we have people signed up on both of them, but we're going to be going back to another hearing as well.
Sure, great. Senate Bill 847, I look at it as a technical fix. There might be somebody that disagrees with it. But it exempts prior converted croplands from the definition of waters of the state. The reason, right now, converted croplands, they could have been converted 100 years ago or more. And those croplands are, it's an exception right now from fill removal permits. And what this basically would do would exclude them from fill removal permits in the future. So it's changing some language in the law. And I think that we need to make sure that we protect these croplands going forward, because croplands, especially in western Oregon, they have a big value, and I think that value is going to be significantly higher in the future. So that's basically what that bill does.
Okay. Any questions for Senator Barrett-Sugar? I don't see any at this point, so.
Perfect.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, we're going to go back to, I don't see any other senators in the room. Okay. I go back to the Senate. I'm managing.
Look under the table, yeah.
My colleague's schedule is managing my schedule right now. I've got a bill to go testify on at 5. We're going to go back to Senate Bill 803. We're still in an open public hearing. That was the bill, you'll recall, to create the spring Chinook fishery in Coos Bay and Tequinna Bay. So we are going to call up the department next. Brett Brownscomb and Ed Bowles, if you could come forward. As brief as possible, okay? As brief as possible. I'm looking at you, Brett. 2 minutes means 2 minutes. 2 minutes does not mean
do we have the timer?
2-0 minutes.
Chair Edwards, members of the committee, for the record, Brett Brownscomb, Acting Deputy Interim Director with Department of Fish and Wildlife, and I hope the timer started. I'll be quick. You've heard a lot about Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife today already, and others have expressed a lot of thoughts, desires on where we go in the future related to hatchery fish and wild fish in other venues, including ongoing discussions related to the department's budget and fee bill. And I'm going to turn this over to Ed Bowles, who is the agency's director of our fish division. Generally, our testimony is going to ideally point out that we are, in fact, doing things already and are promoting or open to promoting more work on economic and social opportunities tied to hatcheries. Contrary to some saying we're not doing enough, it's hard to know when enough is enough, but we are actively working to promote opportunities around hatcheries, and this is an example of it. So I'll end there. Hope that was under 2 minutes.
That was great.
Thank you.
Chair Edwards and members of the committee, Ed Bowles, the Fish Division Administrator for ODFW. And I'm just here to speak briefly about Senate Bill 803, and just a couple key points to point out. One is that, as Senator Roebland mentioned, this is part of a coastal multi-species conservation and management plan that went through a very exhaustive vetting stakeholder process and commission process and was approved this past June. And this is one small element of that, but a very important element. Senator Roebland brought out, we were looking for opportunities with the stakeholders to meet our conservation mandate and actually even move the conservation needle forward, but also find new opportunities to enhance fisheries, particularly during periods of the season and times when fisheries really weren't providing an economic boost. And one of those is in the springtime. And so these two programs are really pilot programs to test the proof of concept as well as evaluate ecological potential impacts before they go prime time into the future. But we really embrace this, the commission embraced this as a part of a way to stimulate springtime economic benefits to the coastal communities. I want to just clarify again that this, through the process, did not identify the color of the money for this program, but the process did identify that this had to be new money and not come out of the existing program funds. And as Senator Roebland mentioned, this was part of an agency request, but is not part of the governor's budget. And therefore, we do not, at the current present time, plan or have plans to implement this piece. So that's I'll stop there. Okay.
Okay. Thank you for that clarification.
Thank you. As I asked Senator Roebland, will this enhance the sport fishery off coast for charter boats?
Chair Edwards and Senator Olson, it will potentially contribute to that, particularly if it's expanded in the future. The spring Chinook will turn north once they exit into the ocean, and so it'll benefit the north coast as well as on all the way up to Vancouver Island.
One follow-up.
Yep.
In Yaquina Bay, well, do you think that'll increase the population of the sea lions that are there?
That's a separate topic that we can go into, Senator Olson, but these will contribute to coastal economic benefits, and those that escape the sea lions will hopefully be caught by springtime fishers, and these are fisheries that will occur probably in May and early June.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right, that's it. Thank you. Jim Myron and Tom Wolf. And then next up will be James Wright, Sean Miller.
Tag team, you're next.
Bill Cluding.
Relay.
And I think that's everybody that's signed up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jim Myron, representing the Native Fish Society. And I want to speak specifically to the issue of the funding mechanism in this bill. As Mr. Bowles mentioned, it had been general fund dollars requested in the agency request budget. The governor did not include that in his budget, and now her budget. So it's not it's not part of the governor's recommended budget. So it sounds to me like these requested general fund dollars may be just bridge dollars for the next 2 years until a permanent funding source is developed. And let me just read you a passage out of the Coastal Salmon Plan that Mr. Bowles was referring to. It'll be implemented only if new long-term secure funding can be obtained for all aspects of the program, rearing, acclimation, and monitoring. So I'm not sure that a two-year bridge loan is considered long-term funding. And we would prefer that this be paid for by the proponents of the plan, either up front or wait until they get the money to do that, or it should be paid for by the commercial and recreational anglers who will benefit from the program. Thank you.
Yeah.
So you're saying Arnie should write a check?
No.
Well, he's on Ways and Means.
I thought that's what he meant.
Go ahead.
Chair Edwards, committee members, for the record, my name is Tom Wolf, the executive director of the Oregon Council of Travel Limited. You have my testimony on the list. I'm just going to bring up a very brief point. We don't support this bill, not because we oppose this hatchery or hatchery program, but because this proposed amount of money was left out of the governor's budget. If they want to bring this back into the governor's budget, they should be sitting at the table with everybody else trying to bring back their program into the budget through the Ways and Means process instead of having a separate bill. Currently, the Western Oregon Stream Restoration Program, which would provide funding and staff for watershed councils, was also cut out of the budget. I'm working hard to put that back in. I think it's unfair for an end run around to do this. If they want to go out and get their funding of their own to support this hatchery and do this program, I mean this hatchery program, that's great, but this should not, we Trout Unlimited opposes this bill and this proposal for funding. Thank you.
Thank you both for your testimony. The only thing I would say as a defender of the legislative process is that it's the legislature that establishes budgets. So this bill would no doubt have a fiscal, would move to Ways and Means, and then they'll duke it out down there. But thank you both. I get what you're saying. Okay. James Wright, Sean Miller, Bill Cluding.
Chairman Edwards, members of the committee. Just on a side note, this morning about 9 o'clock, my daughter.
Name for the record.
I'm James Wright, executive director of Salmon for Oregon Association. This morning at about 9 o'clock, my daughter was elected student body president at Staten High School, and her political career begins. And Fred Gerard should be afraid, I think. So, anyway, Salmon for Oregon Association has been advocating and educating about this concept for 3.5 years. There is much grassroots support. We've raised $130,000 to bring it to this point. When our efforts, we early on went to ODFW and discussed what our concepts were. Director Elliker at the time, sitting not more than 3 feet from me, said, we've been thinking about these kinds of things and your timing is good. We folded our efforts into the coastal management plan, and I would like to praise Ed Bowles and ODFW for their very fine work on vetting and organizing the coastal management plan. It was an extensive effort. ODFW, I'll praise them on this. They did a wonderful job on the coastal management plan. This particular project is economic development using what Oregon has best in its natural resources. We're going to create 45 to 60 new fishing opportunity days for eventually a whole lot of people. Spring fisheries in Yaquina Bay and Coos Bay, where there are none exist at this time, will be an incredible spring boost to both of those economies. We're excited about this. The County of Lincoln, the County of Coos, many top business leaders, including Starker Forest, Freris Lumber, Frank Lumber, and many, many other private individuals supported us in our effort to get to this point. And there's a lot of fishermen, both sports and commercial, who are excited about fishing in the spring in Yaquina Bay. And we will have to find some creative ways to not turn this acclimation project into the lunch bar at the Sea Lion Dock in downtown Newport. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Sean Miller. I'm here today on behalf of the Coastal Conservation Association in support of Senate Bill 803. I just want to point out that on OLIS there is a Steve Godin, the South Coast chapter of CCA, who submitted testimony. We do support the bill. We've had he was a stakeholder in the process. We've had many stakeholders in that process along the coast, and it was very controversial at first. And again, one of the agreements that did ended up coming to agreement is to create some of these opportunities. This is one of those opportunities. And as we get into the budget process, Mr. Chair, as you alluded to, which is a legislative budget, this is a key component of that budget to create more opportunity. You're going to hear that from sport fishermen because they're considering license fee increases. You have to consider opportunity in the sport fishing world. So again, this was an agreement. We do need funding, and I think that decision again would be made down in Ways and Means. So we would encourage the committee to move the bill to Ways and Means and further that conversation down there. And so again, I appreciate the testimony, the opportunity to testify. I just want to note Steve's testimony for the record. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Edwards, committee, for the record. Bill Cluding, a very concerned sportsman. I'll just make this real brief. You know, NOAA come out public now, and spring Chinook could be on the endangered list just in a couple more cycles. The study they did for 4 years, they've stated that over 40% of the springers going up to Columbia do not make the first dam now because of seals and sea lions. Now, she was doing this on account of less than 4,000 seals and sea lions. And we know now there's almost 10,000 and there's more coming. We could lose that whole fishery. Any help we can give these coastal people to maintain a strong strain of spring Chinook, any salmon, any steelhead, we've got to step forward and do it. We need to step forward and demand that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife remove the seals and sea lions from the threatened list. We need to demand that. What they're going to do with them, I have no idea, but we've got to get them out of our river systems, and I'll just stop right there. Thank you.
Any questions for this panel? Thank you each. Okay, so that concludes everybody that was here on Senate Bill 803. So I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 803. And then we have Senator Johnson here. We're continuing our leapfrog process here. So we've closed out a couple of them. We have 846 and 847 that are still open that we opened when Senator Bereshiger kicked it off. Senator Johnson is here to kick off another bill. And so we're going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 544. And then, Senator Johnson, after you speak to 544, if you could also kick off the informational meeting on LC 4094, and we're going to open up an informational meeting on that. So.
Sure. May we come up in a panel?
Yeah, that'd be great. Okay. That's even better.
Okay.
And I will be next door for just a couple minutes, and then I'll be back.
Tahu, take your time, boss.
Marianne's going to do all the text.
Good afternoon, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Betsy Johnson. I represent Senate District 16. I introduced two bills that address related issues facing farmers in Tillamook County and throughout the valley, the construction of wetland projects on land zoned for exclusive farm use. Under current law, the construction of a wetland is permitted outright in an exclusive farm use zone, meaning that the group seeking to create the wetland adjacent to productive farming operations do not have to seek any city or county approval prior to moving forward with the project. As a result, the project's scope and design have not been reviewed or approved by any governmental entity. This can result in situations where the projects are not adequately designed and can cause adverse impacts on neighboring farming operations, primarily in the form of flooding. However, under current law, if the same project is constructed with ODFW or OWEB money, the impacted landowner has no cause of action for the damage caused by the adjacent wetland and may not recover damages for harm caused by the publicly funded wetland. Senate Bill 956 and Senate Bill 544 seek to address these concerns, first by requiring conditional land use approval for the construction of wetlands, that's 956, and secondly by eliminating the liability exemption that attaches when the wetland project is publicly funded, that's Senate Bill 544. And I will defer to others with technical expertise, notably Ms. Nash from the Farm Bureau. Thank you very much for hearing the bills.
Do you want me to go, or do you want me to wait and have these guys go?
Go.
Okay. and I will also just kind of speak on these issues together, because they are somewhat related. My name is Marianne Nash. I am the Public Policy Counsel for the Oregon Farm Bureau. As you guys are aware, Oregon Farm Bureau is a voluntary grassroots nonprofit agricultural organization representing Oregon's farmers and ranchers in the public and policymaking arena. Here today on two bills. The first bill, Senate Bill 956, requires conditional land use approval for wetlands constructed in exclusive farm use zones. Presently, those uses are outright permitted in a farm use zone, which means that if a neighboring landowner has concerns about the impacts of the project on their operation, they have no recourse to the local county planning process to come forward and say, hey, we think there's going to be this impact. Could we require this mitigation measure? Or we think the impact's so severe that the project shouldn't go forward. The first bill, our Senate Bill 956, would require that local county governing body approval prior to constructing these wetland projects in exclusive farm use zones. This permit process would give neighboring landowners a forum to provide evidence on impacts to their farming operations from the project and would require the local governing body to make a finding that the project will not significantly increase the cost of farming practices or force a significant change in farming practices in the area impacted by the project. We feel that this process will result in better project design that would minimize the potential impacts to the neighbor and provide a forum for neighbors to express concerns about the potential impacts to their operations from the wetland. And so we're hoping that this will minimize impacts of wetlands on neighboring agricultural operations and help ensure that farmers in these impacted areas can continue to productively farm. The second bill is somewhat related, and I know there's going to be a lot more discussion on this one to come. But we've introduced dash one amendments on Senate Bill 544, and those are the ones that we would support. As originally drafted, the bill was a little broader in scope than we intended. We were really trying to get at these wetland projects constructed in exclusive farm use zones, and inadvertently in the first draft eliminated the liability protection for forest landowners as well, and liability protections that even attached to some of their forest management practices. And we did not intend to do that. And so the dash one amendments limit this bill to farm properties and non-forest properties. Senate Bill 544 addresses a particular concern that we've heard from members, where we've seen an increase in wetland construction projects in the middle of prime farmland, particularly in the coastal regions of the state. Local farmers are growing very concerned about the increased rate of conversion of farmland to wetland habitats, and concern about the wetland habitat's negative impacts on neighboring operations, as Senator Johnson mentioned, primarily in the form of increased rates of flooding, which can result in crop loss and property damage. In Tillamook County alone, there are currently over 670 acres in conservation ownership, largely former farmlands that were converted to farm use when they were sold into conservation ownership. And these are separate from any projects located on private land that is still in private ownership. So that's conservation group ownership alone. The Tillamook County Commission met this morning to consider a woody debris project in Tillamook County, and there's a pending application in front of OWEB presently for a project that would convert an additional 61 acres of farmland in Tillamook County into wetland use. The group behind the project is seeking about $262,000 in state funding through OWEB for this project. Under current law, the proponents are the landowners involved in this project, in this case the conservation group, would be exempt from any harm to neighbors caused by the wetland construction or operation. This project is one of many throughout the coastal regions conducted with funding from ODFW or OWEB. Presently, the owners of the neighboring farmland are left without any ability to seek reparation for the loss caused by the wetland projects. I think you'll hear later from folks who say there's some recourse against the state for state involvement or contractors who construct wetland projects. From what I'm hearing from members, these are not effective or terribly readily available means of seeking recourse. And in one of the projects I'm talking about, I think the statute of limitations for the subsequent flooding would have long since passed. So Senate Bill 544 eliminates the landowner and operator liability exemption and places farmers next to OWEB projects on even footing with landowners next to projects funded through other private sources. In the testimony I handed out, you'll see a picture in there. Just wanted to show kind of some of what we are talking about. So those pictures are from a hayfield in Yamhill County that floods on a nearly yearly basis due to a wetland lake area that was constructed with the help of ODF&W. The owner of the lake allows it to overflow every year, causing damage to the farmer's property. When the lake's flooded onto the farmer's property, the farmer cannot plow, plant, harvest, or spray for noxious weeds. The farmer has requested repeatedly that the landowner not allow the lake to overflow onto his property, but the owner of the property refuses to maintain the lake at a level that would avoid flooding. This is a prime example of a scenario where existing law bars recourse by the farmer simply because of the state's role in this project. Senate Bill 544 would eliminate this exemption and incentivize the managers of these wetland and habitat projects to manage their property in a way that avoids these adverse impacts on neighboring farming operations. So with that, since I know we're all eager to get out of here, I will conclude, but would welcome any questions you have on either bill.
Thank you. Commissioner, please. You want Chad to go first? Sure.
All right. My name is Chad Allen. I'm a dairyman in Tillamook, and I'd like to thank you for this opportunity to speak to you guys today. Years ago, when some of these conversions were going on, the assumption was this is EFU, it's protected, and this can't happen. That was found out not to be the case. Our EFU zoning laws are real cumbersome and got a lot of detail to them. But there's that fine little sentence in there that talks about the creation enhancement of wetlands is now right use. When these land conversions happen and these projects are completed, these lands are still zoned EFU, although they'll never be farmed again. And so in any other situation where farm ground is taken out of production and turned into an alternative use, there's a public process that's gone through. And it's evaluated for its proposed use and its historical use, and if things, you know, it keeps working forward, and their decisions are made, public input is included, and all these things are allowed. Every 2 years, there is a report that's brought out from Department of Land Conservation and Development that talks about all the acres in every county that are taken out of development. There's one section in there talks about the land conversion trends, and if I could, I'd just like to read this. The great majority of rural land conversions occur through the approval of various non-farm and non-forest uses. Conversions occur both through the physical loss of agriculture and forest land via development, what is called the shadow effect of development on the nearby resource land. The shadow effect refers to the adverse impacts are conflicts that some of these non-farm and non-forest uses can have on farm and forest operations. These conflicts can interfere with accepted farm and forest practices and raise land costs, lead to the loss of farm and forest infrastructure, and promote the eventual conversion of resource lands to other uses. Non-farm and non-forest uses with the potential for conflict include large-scale land-intensive uses, aggregate operations, golf courses, and wetland creation. This is a report that's from Department of Land Conservation. When we start looking at defining high-value farm ground, we have all these things in our state statute that allow for certain things if it's been determined not to be high-value farm ground. And based on ORS 215-710, it states that in addition to land described in subsection 1 of this section for the purpose of ORS 215-705 high-value farm ground, if west of the summit of the Coast Range is used in conjunction of a dairy operation on January 1st of 1993 includes tracts composed predominantly, and it has a list of soils, is determined to be high-value farm ground. So in all these land conversions to wetlands, Oregon is losing high-value farm ground. This isn't marginal ground. This isn't ground that's been in non-use for 20 years or hasn't created any economic development. In Tillamook, a couple of different places, the one on Pacetti Road, which was back in 2010, was purchased by the Nature Conservancy at a rate of $8,085 an acre. That's twice the going rate for land. In 2009, on 75-acre parcel bought by U.S. Fish and Wildlife, paid $10,951.81 per acre for that land. And these were active dairy farms. They went from milking cows to selling their cows to selling to these conservancies. And so moving these bills forward isn't really a choice between conservation, between ag. It's a choice to allow for a democratic process. If these are valid projects and they go through the conditional use permitting process, they move forward with community support and they become a very positive aspect of the community. Right now, these small communities really just have their hands tied and there's nothing they can do. We have all these outside funding sources coming in and we have nothing we can do about it. So I would urge you guys to move this further down the line so we can continue these conversations. This is really important to Oregon to maintain their high-value farm ground in their production, not only for me, but for the future of my family and all the young people that want to get involved in farming. If you decrease your supply, it increases costs, and you really shut the door of opportunity for younger people to get in this of any kind of ag. So thank you for your time.
Chair Edwards. For the record, Mark Labhart, I am a Tillamook County Commissioner, and also I'm today representing the Association of Oregon Counties. I sit on their board and also on their legislative committee, so I'll be speaking wearing two hats today. First, I'm going to be less than 2 minutes, Senator Edwards, so you'll know that. I just want to thank you all for your attention. I've been a commissioner for 11 years. I know what it's like to sit for all day long listening to testimony, and so I appreciate your diligence and your efforts to do that. You could have got up and left a long time ago, and appreciate very much that you're making the time to do that. I'm not going to talk about 544, 846, 847, because I've already got some written testimony that should be in your hands from our Board of Commissioners on that. I want to speak specifically to 956. You heard testimony. I've been here for the last several hours listening to his testimony, and we talked about Senate Bill 100 and the importance of farmland and forest land, and that's what Senate Bill 100 is the protection of farm and forest land. And what we're talking about today is an erosion of our prime farm and forest land in Oregon. And I'm not going to speak just for Tillamook County, even though, you know, we're the land of trees, cheese, and ocean breeze. I'm speaking for the rest of the Oregon counties that are losing valuable farmland. This bill, at the time of this writing, the conversion to wetlands on EFU land is a ministerial review that is not noticed to the public and not subject to a LUBA appeal. As such, the loss of this valuable farmland is allowed to advance unhindered, even by minimal public review process that a myriad of other users are required to undergo. That is a very powerful statement. As non-marginal lands county, which we are, that refers to ORS 215-283, our permitted use on exclusive farm lands, we process these sorts of applications as conditional uses, which provides for a public process and appeal rights for those with standing. While the criteria for approval are sometimes problematic from a staff side, it is important part that this bill would allow concerned citizens and entities in counties to have a greater voice in issues that could impact their economic viability. And Chad has talked to you about the economic viability of losing valuable farmland. We only have so much in Tillamook County. We only have so much in Yamhill County, in Polk County, and Hood River County. We've got to protect this valuable farmland. We support and appreciate the efforts to restore wetlands. Nobody's arguing that. We need to restore wetlands, but we need to do it in the right spots. We need to restore critical biological habitat. However, we do not feel that such a worthy cause can come at the cost of incongruence of interests for our farming community and by the extension of a large part of our county's economic identity. Indeed, these two uses can peacefully coexist. I feel that strongly. They can coexist. This is not a win-lose thing here. Subject to wetland restoration project, these criteria seem like very reasonable compromise to protect the rights of both interests. This has to be resolved at the state level. We can't resolve it at the county level. We've got an appeal that's going on right now that people say, oh, you got to resolve this at the county level. This is a state law that we need to resolve. You need to help fix this. We need to protect our farm and forest lands, and it's in your hands to help us do that. We ask for your support for this bill. Thank you.
Thank you each. Questions for this panel?
Yeah. Thanks, Mr. Chair. This is with respect to 544, so maybe Marianne. So, you know, I look at the example that you have with the photos and the flooding, and I just, it seems to me that if this is happening repeatedly and the conservancy owner or whoever it is that owns the wetland is repeatedly, there's a complaint to them, and they refuse to do anything, that seems like gross negligence to me. You know? I mean, why can't that be addressed under the current statute?
Chair Edwards, Senator Dimbrough, I think that's part of the issue with the standard is when you have a gross negligence standard, everybody says, okay, that means something. You can do something with that, and it absolutely does. But in my experience, gross negligence is a relatively high bar to hit. And you don't necessarily meet it by showing, you know, if he's not engaging in any sort of active wrongdoing or if there's not a, you know, a particular structural fault in the project or in the lake area, it may not rise to the level of gross negligence. And it's a standard for the court to decide. But negligence, simple negligence, is a much easier bar to meet. And I think can be much more focused on the impacts that you're having versus gross negligence, which is just a higher legal hurdle. Not to say that this situation doesn't rise to that level. It very well may. But I think this is just kind of one more extreme example of issues we've been seeing where, you know, maybe in a lot of them, it's, you know, a small engineering design error, probably pure negligence, but still having very real impacts on the ground. And so gross negligence, it is just a higher legal bar. And with that being so subjective in the courts, I think courts ascribe a fairly decent hurdle to that.
Yeah. So just a follow-up. Are we seeing many examples in which people are trying to claim negligence or gross negligence, rather, and what they're finding is that that's being dismissed because they're not meeting that high bar?
Right.
I mean, I'm just wondering how much evidence there is for this as a real problem.
Yeah. So, Chair Edwards, Senator Dimbrough, I that's a really interesting question and one I was actually kind of hoping you would ask, because I think that what's happened in a lot of these communities is folks here, and it's unfortunate, you know, not every person can go consult an attorney every time they have an issue. I think folks have heard, well, there's this liability bar. If it's a state project, and I know state monies were involved, there's just a bar to liability. And yes, maybe people could be more proactive about hiring an attorney and figuring out if they think that they have this gross negligence standard and knowing that that's a kind of loophole that would eliminate the liability protection. But really what we're hearing is people say, yeah, I know that there's a liability bar and it was a state-funded project and I guess I just have to live with this annoyance. You know, I think there's been a couple cases where there's been crop damage and folks have tried to, you know, connected close in time to when the project was constructed, and have tried to look to the state or the contractor for those claims. But in a case like this where it's years old and there's a state actor and it happens repeatedly, I think they think, oh, there's a liability bar and I know that and I've been told that. And my hunch is that, you know, quite a while ago, somebody tried to sue the state sue the landowner and the liability bar was raised and that word of mouth just got out that, yeah, you can't bring these kinds of lawsuits. And so that's an absolute outreach program that we're trying to do on the current state of the law. But to me, I think we need to have that simple negligence action back, and folks need to know that there is just an absolute remedy for these types of projects and for impacts that they have on their agricultural operations. And to me, to do otherwise is prioritizing wetlands use in an EFU over the agricultural use. And for us at Farm Bureau, that's, we'd like to see that at least be on a level playing field.
Thank you each for your testimony. And I want to clarify for the record, because mentions were made to a bill. This was posted as an informational hearing on LC 4094, because at the time of posting, Senate Bill 956 had not been printed yet, and we didn't have it. So this hearing that we have today does not count for the public hearing requirements for Senate Bill, what is now Senate Bill 956. So we really, this was an informational meeting, hearing only, invited testimony. I'm going to close the informational hearing on LC 4094, and we remain in the public hearing currently on Senate Bill 544. So, and while I was gone, did you both testify to 544?
Yes. Okay. And I'm happy to come back for questions after the other panelists go as well.
Okay. Then I think we're up to our next panel then. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'd like to call I know that everybody's not necessarily on the same page here, but I'm just putting together panels of three. Roger Beyer, Tom Wolf, and Kelly Beamer. And then next up will be Meta Lofsgaarden, Brett Brownscombe, and Bill Ryan. And I think, no, and then we'll be going back to some folks on 846 and 847. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
2 minutes if you can, please.
No problem. I'm Roger Beyer, here representing not only the Oregon Dairy Farmers, but Oregon Seed Council on Senate Bill 544. You've heard from the dairy farmers, so I'm going to speak to an example to get to Senator Dembrough's question about a real-life example. I have a seed grower in the Southern Wyoming Valley who is, his neighbor put in a wetland project using state funds to help pay for that. It then flooded a 40-acre parcel he had been growing grass seed on, made the parcel completely unusable for grass seed. He went to an attorney and tried to get some recourse, found out there was negligence in the design of the wetland that allowed the wetland from his neighbor put in to flood his property, but because state funds were used in the project and it was not gross negligence, it was simply negligence, he had no recourse. So he now has a 40-acre wetland on his farm, which he did not ask for, did not want, and still does not want, but there's nothing he can do about it because state funds were used in the project to fund the project. This would have given him recourse in that action had we had just simple negligence. At least he could have gotten something back for his now wetland. So, Mr. Chair, just a real-life example, I wanted to make sure that we got put on the record. And so there are others out there. I don't know how many more there are, but there was simply that one that was just a few years ago. Thank you.
Thank you for that testimony and that example. Go ahead.
Thank you. Chair Edwards, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kelly Beamer. I'm the executive director of the Coalition of Oregon, the Coalition of Oregon Land Trusts. I'm submitting testimony today on behalf of three organizations, the Coalition of Oregon Land Trusts, the Network of Oregon Watershed Councils, and the Oregon Association of Conservation Districts. You have the written testimony in front of you, and I'll try to be brief. There's good efficiencies to partnering in this testimony. You don't have to hear from all three of us. But together, we represent 160 organizations that work across Oregon with willing landowners to accomplish voluntary conservation and restoration across Oregon. Our three organizations oppose Senate Bill 544 that would limit liability protections for landowners that are engaging in voluntary restoration. These liability protections are really critical tools for our members to work with landowners who are participating in habitat and wetlands improvement projects. Removing this liability would severely curtail their ability to build these on-the-ground relationships with landowners who are ultimately helping us reach incredible public benefits here in Oregon. Our state approach to conservation has really been through this outreach on private lands that allows landowners to do fish and wildlife habitat restoration and conservation. And this would reverse a long-established law that we have in Oregon to protect these landowners. I also just want to point out that our concern is we've heard today of some specific geographies, wetlands particularly, and we do support talking about these issues in a regional conversation and regional level. Bringing it to a legislative mandate that would have impact statewide is of concern to all three of our organizations. We really support the development of a task force and the ability to have these conversations on a continual basis beyond this hearing. And all three, OACD, COLT, and the network, would want to be partners in those conversations and really help support that moving forward. So again, we feel concerned about the way this would penalize voluntary landowners and oppose the bill and appreciate the opportunity to speak before you today.
Thank you. Questions?
Ms. Beamer, I can understand people want to do conservation. It's interesting, in this one day we've talked about we can't convert farmland to industrial land, but we can convert farmland into wetland. The question I'm asking is, how is it okay for a person that converts their farmland to encroach, or their, converts their farmland into wetland, to allow that wetland to encroach someone else's land and take away the ability of the other person to provide or to farm their land as they wish? Why is that okay?
I don't think anyone wants to see that happen, and I think that, you know, that what we're hearing are some of the stories where there are grievances, and we want to explore, you know, recourse and how those issues can be addressed in a way that would be on a local level. I don't think, you know, anyone has you know, any difference of opinion on that matter. And I do think what we're not seeing is the success stories where there are those really positive neighbor-neighbor relationships where we're seeing conservation benefits happen around the state, and it is it's working. It really is. So,
I can appreciate success stories, but those stories that we've heard that actually exist, how can you not allow that person that has been harmed to receive damages for what they can't produce?
I believe at this point, Vice Chair Olson, that landowner does have recourse through the agencies that is a partner in the restoration project, the state agencies, as well as, say, a land trust is partnering and goes on to that land to do the restoration project. The neighbor does have legal recourse through those partnering entities, not just the landowner themselves.
Yeah. Does anybody know if that's true?
Mr. Chair, I'll just speak to the landowner. I'm aware of. He did hire a lawyer, did have a lawyer look at into it, and was told he had no recourse because of their state funds were used. That's
I believe, if I may, Executive Director Lafsgarden is here to perhaps offer some insight into that.
Well, we can do that.
That is an excellent pivot to the next panel.
Thank you. All right. Good.
Meta Lafsgarden, Brett Brownscombe, and Bill Ryan. And that will conclude the panels on Senate Bill 544.
Hey, no smacking on the way up now.
It was purely unintentional, Vice Chair Olson.
Give the same 2-minute admonishment, which I am obviously being really
You're blowing
loose
it.
With the enforcement of, but
Chair
it's a strong hint.
Chair Edwards, members of the committee, for the record, Maida Lafsgarden, Executive Director of the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board. I'm speaking with information regarding Senate Bill 544. We are a state agency that provides on average about $70 million a biennium in grants for both water quality improvements and native fish and wildlife habitat restoration. I want to speak to a couple pieces of the bill. First, and it was mentioned previously, Oregon has a very unique approach in working with private landowners to do voluntary restoration work on the ground. We are, in fact, a national leader in the work that we do, and this statute that's in place is a piece of that. As an example, through U.S. Department of Agriculture, we were the single largest recipient of regional conservation partnership funding in the nation. That's due to how we approach our voluntary work with soil and water conservation districts, watershed councils, land trusts, and others on the ground. We were originally created, our agency, as a collaborative venture between farmers, ranchers, and environmentalists to seek voluntary approaches to conservation and restoration. This bill has that same approach, trying to really provide the opportunity for agencies to work directly with landowners to achieve restoration benefits. And we do a huge range of conservation practices. So when we talk about restoration in this bill, that also includes work on riparian habitat. This isn't just about wetlands. The bill would impact a broad range of restoration activities that take place on the ground, sage-grouse habitat, riparian habitat, and others. We recommend, as was mentioned in the previous testimony, that a task force take a further look at this. And fingers crossed, next week, Senate Bill 204 with a -1 amendment will be in front of this committee. That includes a task force, and one of the areas that it's to address is to study issues regarding compatibility of conservation actions carried out on adjacent farmland. So we think that's a great place for this conversation to occur, and would encourage that conversation over the next biennium so that we can come forward with some solid recommendations. Thank you.
Thank you. That was 2 minutes and 6 seconds. That was pretty good. That was pretty good.
I'll go.
Yeah. That's another signal to you, Brett.
Hard act to follow there. Chair Edwards, members of the committee, Bill Ryan, Department of State Lands. I'm the assistant director in charge of the Aquatic Resource Management Program. We have submitted some testimony just today for the committee. Just want to hit a couple of points. And first of all, that the department, as part of our conservation mission, very much supports the voluntary habitat restoration efforts. We are concerned that removing the liability protections might result in a reduction in the amount of voluntary restoration that occurs. I would like to point out that most of the restoration, the vast majority of the restoration projects that do occur for wetland restoration are areas that were formerly wetlands. I mean, those are the primary areas that you're likely to actually try to do a restoration effort on. And do want to make it clear that the department actually is part, almost any of these restoration projects would require a removal fill permit from the department. And we do look at the effects, hydrologic and others, to adjacent properties as part of that permit process, and often will require a hydrologic analysis, engineering analysis, and stamps that basically certify that there won't be a significant effect to adjacent properties or to hydrology downstream. And that's just part of the regular permitting process. And with that, I'll finish.
Minute 20. That was good.
Can I have your 40 seconds?
I'd like to give my 40 seconds.
What's the difference?
Trapping and trading.
Chair Edwards, members of the committee, Brett Brownscombe, acting interim deputy director with the Department of Fish and Wildlife. So I'll be brief and submit follow-up comments in writing. What I wanted to add to the testimony already submitted was it's just for the Department of Fish and Wildlife, our mission is to protect and enhance the fish, wildlife, and their habitat of Oregon, and to promote the public's use and enjoyment of those resources. However, as an agency, we don't own much land, and we are not, in the traditional sense of the meaning, a regulatory agency. So in order to achieve our mission and the public's the public elements of the agency's mission, we have to rely on voluntary restoration and habitat improvement projects that are not only effective, but that rest upon good working relationships with private landowners and a host of other people engaged in this work. So this work over time has been critically important in Oregon's efforts to avert more cumbersome, less flexible regulatory impositions that are more top-down than the voluntary ground-up approach, such as listings under the Endangered Species Act. This work has been critical in the state's efforts around coastal coho salmon, which, but for litigation, we believe would have been successful and will be critical in determining where our path goes in the future related to opportunities to achieve a delisting, as well as work on species like sage grouse to prevent a listing. So what I would add to what's already been said is just that this kind of work is it is ongoing. The there is a lot of care put in when ODFNW engages in these projects in ensuring that concerns to or risks to neighboring landowners are addressed. And there's a lot of effort that goes into the design of projects and the execution as well as the monitoring of projects to ensure that occurs. When it doesn't happen, obviously there's something that's broken down, and it's an example of where a failure's occurred in a project, and that is a concern, and it needs to be addressed. The liability protection currently in statute is something that we believe is important and has been a really effective way to incent engagement in voluntary restoration work. So to the extent there are negative impacts to neighboring landowners occurring from habitat projects, this is not a good thing. I mean, we'd like to know more about the extent to which this is happening. It's not something that's commonly reported to us, but where it is existing and how much it's existing is an important question. Eroding the trust of landowners and the general public in habitat restoration work is in nobody's interest. And that's because working farms and their value to Oregon, as well as the spirit of voluntary restoration in this state, are both core parts of Oregon's fabric. And that's the department's view. And I'll stop there. I don't know how many minutes that is, but thank you for the opportunity to comment.
I believe in praising publicly and correcting privately, so I won't say anything like that.
Just one simple question, and then I asked the last panel. What happens when there is an infringement on another person's property and they have no legal recourse? They suffer losses, but the people that, because it's public money, they get away with doing it. What do you guys do?
So, Senator Edwards, Vice Chair Olson, I think the challenge in this, and part of the reason that I think looking at this through a more thorough task force process is important, is that the assumption is that the landowner is the only place of recourse, the neighboring landowner. And as was mentioned previously, there are contractors with liability insurance. There are the organizations, the Watershed Councils, Conservation Districts, Land Trusts, who have liability coverage. I know of one example in a relationship with a federal agency where that impact happened. The federal agency came out. They fixed it. They fixed the tile drain on the neighboring property and fixed the wetland issue. Our contention is that there are other avenues to look at, and I think a task force and a more thorough look at this will describe that in a way that the landowners who are impacted have a really clear understanding of where their areas of recourse are. And I think focusing that recourse solely on the neighboring landowner may be a false sense of focus, and I think we've got some other opportunities to look at what the broader liability range may be.
Well, I'd kind of say that if you bought a new car and you drove it off the lot and the tire went flat, you'd blame the guy that sold you the car. So your neighbor, if his water's coming onto your land, you'd blame him. And who else do you – I mean, you want the guy to get a lawyer and sue 26 people to figure out who's going to pay for what the landowner did? He's liable for it. It's his.
In many cases, these things are designed by outside contractors, particularly when we talk about wetland projects. As Mr. Ryan mentioned, there's a lot of permitting, there's engineering designs, and so those are through again, more intensive processes. It's not typically the landowner who's doing this on their own property, particularly when state dollars are involved. So we do think there's an opportunity to just take a more thorough look at this across all of the interested parties.
So follow up with Mr. Please. Ryan, do you have certified engineers, hydrologists on your staff that you can determine if these plans are in fact accurate and will work?
Chair Edwards, Senator Olson, no, we do not. We, you know, depending upon what the issue and the question is, we will look for outside help. We actually have worked with engineers and hydrologists from, say, ODOT or from ODA. ODFW also has some staff that we've tapped into for that level of expertise.
And I won't go any further.
Okay. Thank you each for your testimony. We're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 544. We still have one panel to go. Bill Ryan, why don't you stay right there for Senate Bill 846 and 847. I will also call up Marianne Nash Rich Angstrom, and April Snell. And 846, Assembly 846, you'll recall, is the task force on ditches and salmon habitat, for lack of a better description. And the Senate Bill 847 exempts prior converted croplands from the definitions of waters of the state for purposes of removal of fill.
Chair Edwards, do you want to start both at the same time in our testimony?
Yep, that would be great.
Okay. Oh, I didn't mean to lead off. Chair Edwards, members of the committee, my name is Mary Ann Nash. I'm the Public Policy Counsel for the Oregon Farm Bureau. We are here today in support of both 846 and 847. As you are aware, Senate Bill 846 directs DSL to convene a task force to study essential salmon and indigenous anadromous salmon habitat and its relationship to ditches and other man-made water conveyance channels. In the past few years, we have seen an increase in DSL's assertion of jurisdiction over ditches and other man-made water conveyance channels, particularly in situations where DSL claims they may house essential salmon habitat. We have received, I mean, this has been one of the number one issues since I joined Farm Bureau in December that I've received calls about of kind of the relationship between ditches and man-made conveyance channels and streams and disputes with DSL about what is what and how they should be handled. And so we think this is a long overdue study and conversation with DSL. I've spoken with Mr. Ryan about it on a few occasions, and I think DSL is also interested in addressing this issue. So we think this is a great vehicle through which to have those conversations and move that ball forward. Senate Bill 847, we don't think will result in significant changes to DSL's current practices. DSL's removal fill law currently contains an exemption for activities located on prior converted cropland. One of the ways to show that the land is prior converted cropland is through an NRCS certification. So this bill turns that exemption into an exception from jurisdiction, providing that DSL does not have jurisdiction over prior converted cropland that has a certification from NRCS. This will avoid DSL being able to place additional restrictions on use of that land in the future and provides landowners with certainty that they will be able to continue to farm the land without interference from DSL so long as they have their certification. So we urge you to support both 846 and 847.
Bill, do you care if I go? Go ahead.
Okay.
Good afternoon. Rich Angstrom, Oregon Concrete Aggregate Producers Association. I think this bill, I'm going to speak to 847. This bill is an attempt, from my view, is try to line up the federal law and the state law. Currently, it's one of those situations on wetlands where the federal government has jurisdiction as well as the state. And there's a long history that path that has led to the issue that I think came forward that led to this bill. But this bill actually, the issue really actually extended quite a long time ago when the Clean Water Act was first put into place. And in Louisiana, a farmer was tilling his field, and because the soil was rolling over, the federal government determined that that was a fill and then regulated it, the conduct under the Clean Water Act. Of course, the farm community said, no way, you know, that's our farm field. And they say, well, it used to be a wetland. So that's kind of ground zero. And from that point then, the feds handled it because of the ire that was raised by exempting essentially prior converted wetlands from most farm-related activities. And the issues kind of progressed because the state, and the date is about 1985 is when all of this happened. And so anything prior to that, the feds say, we're not going to regulate it and as far as agricultural conflicts. For quite a long period of time, what the feds also said was, is these wetlands were so degraded that we're not going to pick up jurisdiction when they're converted. And so I come in from the conversion side of it, right, because we buy and then we convert them. The state picked it up and had kind of a parallel track, and I think that's what's important. So you end up with kind of the federal government regulating prior, not regulating and kind of regulating prior converted croplands, and the state having a little bit of a different approach. When the fill and removal law first went into effect in Oregon, those two approaches were supposed to be the same. And over time, those approaches diverged. And so you ended up with some differences in how the feds treated prior converted croplands and how the state did. That put all of us from a permitting side of things in kind of a box because we have basically two approaches to deal with. Recently, though, is that started to narrow again. And it's all over conversion. Really, it kind of stays the same as far as the farm-related activities. But from the conversion side, there's been a move that if there's any conversion, that you lose your prior converted designation. Well, in 2005, I'll get right to the point here. In 2005, the Army Corps of Engineers and EPA did an MOA that basically said that if you convert, we're going to start regulating if the site has habitat value and is hydrologically connected in some kind of fashion. The state's always taken the approach that if you convert, period, you're back under regulation. So there's still a gap. And I got to give you this history so you understand what I think Bert Sugar was putting together. There's still a gap between how the federal and the state are handling it, but it's really narrowed up now. It's a fairly fine difference between the two. Just before I got in here, I was questioning whether the 2005 amendments or MOA between the two federal agencies actually stuck. And what Steve Schell and Paul Rieberneck told me on the phone outside was that it looks like it was challenged in both the Florida jurisdiction and the fifth jurisdiction at the federal level, and the MOA was not well received. They were supposed to do some rulemaking on it, which was put on hold. So actually, I think it kind of expands it back out a little bit is where it sits right now. What Bert Sugar is trying to get at, though, is by deleting it out of the state waters, you essentially divert the whole discussion to applying how the federal process is going to go. And I think that's what he's trying to get to, is not have two processes, just exempt us from regulating prior converted croplands and let us follow the federal path. So with that, we've been supportive of that, and I apologize I took a little more time, but somebody's got to give the background of how this all got to where we got to. So.
No, I appreciate it. Once again, I believe that I should have gone to law school instead of natural resource law. Go ahead, either of you.
Okay. So I'll stay. Sorry, Bill Ryan, Department of State Lands. I'll address Senate Bill 847 first. So basically, under current statute, we do have that alignment with federal law. And so current statute has a really, really broad exemption for agricultural activities on lands that are certified as prior converted cropland by the Natural Resource Conservation Service and are located on EFU-designated lands. And so basically, anything that you're doing, as long as it's associated with agricultural use, building barns and buildings, doing feedlots, construction of commercial riding stables and arenas, all kinds of development-type activities, but they're agriculturally related, are allowed without any removal fill permit requirement on those lands. And so to get at what Rich was talking about, I don't think it really changes the conversion piece technically, because that PCC designation from the federal government, from the NRCS, that is invalidated if there is a conversion from agricultural use. I mean, that certification that says you don't need to comply with the Clean Water or you don't need to be regulated by the Army Corps of Engineers goes away if you change your use to a non-agricultural use. And so as this bill is written, if that occurred, then the DSL would basically, that certification would go away, that PCC designation would go away, and so the removal fill law would apply to those lands, the ones that were wetlands subject to DSL jurisdiction. And so that wouldn't happen. So it's really more of a concern that it doesn't really change the operations of what occurs on farmland that's designated PCC, but if farmers have been operating under the knowledge, under this proposed bill, if they're operating under the knowledge that these lands are not subject to the removal fill law, there might be a greater likelihood that if they did do a conversion to a non-agricultural use, that wouldn't trigger them to actually come to DSL to get a removal fill permit, and that there wouldn't be the public process associated with getting a permit. So that's the department's concern with this approach. Essentially, it doesn't really change the operations of farms and what they're allowed to do or not allowed to do under the removal fill law compared to current situation. And so just wanted to make that. The other thing that's really important to to say, and that's actually in the context of Senate Bill 846 and waterways, is that that prior converted designation does not apply to streams or ditches or to ponds. It's really specific to wetlands. And so the challenges that are trying to be addressed with Senate Bill 846 would not be solved by 847. So just wanted to make that clear. And so then I'd also like to then move on to 846, and basically the department agrees that that the challenge of figuring out how to balance the protection of the environmental values, the fisheries and water quality resources of these waterways in ag lands, with allowing them to be maintained and operated as needed for those agricultural uses is a real challenge, and to do so in a way that is regulatorily not burdensome or as least burdensome as possible is a great challenge. And so it's definitely an issue that the department is interested in tackling with agricultural interests and conservation interests, obviously, as well. I do have some concerns about the about staffing and the fiscal impact of doing so and having a forced timeline in terms of doing a reporting or a rulemaking associated with that. We're being asked to do a lot of rulemaking and serve on a lot of task force, and I've got a staff of 30 to do permitting statewide, and so I'm just concerned about resources, but agree that it's an issue that we do need to address and that we're happy to address.
April.
Thank you. For the record, April Snell with the Oregon Water Resources Congress, and I'm here to testify on Senate Bill 846, as we do not have a position on Senate Bill 847. OWRC represents irrigation districts, water control districts, and other agricultural water supply entities across the state. These water stewards operate complex water delivery systems that serve one-third of all the irrigated land in the state. And Senate Bill 846 is an important issue to us because the process in which essential salmon habitat is designated is not always very aware to those in the agricultural community. For example, there was a recent addition of many places for the essential salmon habitat last fall, and there was a map that folks could click on to determine whether there was essential salmon habitat in their area and be able to comment on that. However, it was very site specific, and as an organization, we struggled with how we would provide guidance to our members on how to address this. And there were a couple instances that were discovered of canals that had no return to natural waterways that were designated as essential salmon habitat. And I think for us, the issue is not that there should not be essential salmon habitat, but there needs to be a closer look at the relationship between the activities that we do that are designed to preserve fish habitat in alignment with removal fill for ditches and canals that are very different from streams. And we think that looking at this through a task force would allow the opportunity to come up with solutions that work for both the management agencies and the farmers and irrigators who are responsible for not only making sure they have water for their farms, which would involve them being able to clean out their canals, but also so that they're aware of any essential salmon habitat designations they may have and be able to work with DSL to come up with measures to ensure that the things that they're doing are not going to endanger fish. And I really think that is the key piece, is that there needs to be some greater coordination and communication between our interests. And farmers are just out there doing their job and growing food. They don't have time to pay attention to salmon habitat maps. And then they may find out the hard way after that designation has been made that they can get in trouble when they're doing what they consider to be normal activities. We would be open to discussing an amendment maybe that would clarify that the task force to reduce the fiscal impact on DSL, that any participants on the task force would not be entitled to expense reimbursement or something of that nature. But I think it is an important issue that deserves further conversation. And I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for the panel? All right. Thank you each for being here. That's everybody that signed up. So we're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 846, close the public hearing on Senate Bill 847, and we are adjourned. Thank you for your patience, committee members. Thank you for your patience, committee members. And we are adjourned.